contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
Zombie. Just when you thought that you may have heard everything that Douglas Diedrich can bring up and talk about in our past four sessions with him, well, he has more. Of course, he has much more than we've ever brought up in here on the topics. It's very dense. And so look forward to books, videos, and whatnot to go in much more detail. And also you can see Douglas live. We'll get to that in a second. Zombies. Well, you know, there's been news stories of a guy in Florida who attacked somebody, killed him, was eating his face off, and was naked. There's a video of that. Luckily, the video wasn't completely graphically located, but it was good enough. And at least what I saw wasn't, which is okay with me. And so people go, oh, wow, what's a zombie? And, you know, of course, you have the whole zombie movies, the zombie apocalypse, you have the history of zombies, Night of the Living Dead, etc. And one thinks, well, you know, that's all fiction. But as we look in the past and throughout history, you see things like vampires and other lore. And now you find there are some biological explanations for them. Well, this is one of those cases. And Douglas has three that I could see I've written down from talking with him off air. There's basically three ways to be a zombie, and we'll get into all of that. Douglas Diedrich, you know, has worked for the Department of Defense as research librarian for almost a decade, responsible for considering highly classified data on critical historical topics such as Pearl Harbor, Roswell, Vietnam, and different ethnic holocausts, as well as exposing the reality behind vampire, zombies, Soviet psychic warfare, and other cult phenomena. Volumes of notes on Tesla, H.P. Lovecraft, L. Ron Hubbard, the Vatican, the United Nations were destroyed, along with reams of reports dealing with everything from military intelligence-sponsored drug smuggling operations to experimental mind control programs. Records plundered from both ally and enemy states articulate the hidden objectives of modern mass movements such as Nazism, Zionism, Isaism, Islamic fundamentalism, Voodooism, etc. And so from that position, he has seen a lot of things. He took notes, got the little spy, you know, like in the movies, little spy pictures, whatever, did traces, did all kinds of stuff, has a very good memory, and he's put together all these notes and is coming out and sharing with us to get the record straight. We've heard him in the past talk about World War II, Roswell, Nazi, Satanism, etc. And tonight we'll be talking about the zombieism stuff. And I want to welcome back Douglas Diedrich.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much to your audience for being with us. Now that you've changed your nights to a night that might be more convenient for all of us.
Yeah, it might be. You know, it's one of those deals where people are going to like it, people aren't. And I really hated the change, but it was a question of whether to stay live or whether to go pre-recorded. And from the feedback I got with people, some may migrate to the archive version because of their timing. But even with that, they prefer it live Even if it was going, if they're going to list the recorded, they'd like to have it live when it was made. So that was the decision.
Great, and I think that with you acting as the guide, we'll have one heck of a ride tonight. We'll be addressing certainly these new wave of zombie attacks or zombie murders, as they've been called by the media. I want to put them into perspective in light of the Haitian and ultimately pan-Caribbean and ultimately pan-American phenomena of the condition of zombism, and how that impacts what we've witnessed lately in terms of the designer drug known as salt baths, or bath salts, excuse me. And you certainly want to put all of that forward to your audience. But perhaps you can refresh my memory when we were talking off camera and we were talking about the three ways in terms of...
Well, I was writing up a little report here, and I came up with three. One is from cannibalism, another is from a voodoo drug, and the third was from the neutron bomb.
Right, and let's get into that right away.
Well, actually, let's stop here for 1 second. We were talking, and before we get into the meat of this, we were talking off the air. There were some accusations hurled at you, and I said, well, you know, let's talk about it on the air, given that included with talking about it on the air is included in it is an automatic invite for this this individual or individuals, excuse me, to come on the air here for a gentlemanly conversation to work out these issues, if they are workoutable, if that's such a word. And so why don't you go into that before we get into the meat and potatoes of the evening?
Sure. And what we'll do is we'll walk a line probably between that issue and the zombie phenomena throughout the night, kind of talking between one or the other, because I think that the individual, John Lear, in question, with what he's accused me of, has raised a number of questions in tandem with that that I would be happy to address as briefly as I can. So basically what happened was that John Lear publicly wrote on a forum that happened to be Godlike Productions, and it was a forum that has since appeared on Project Camelot and Project Avalon. So basically he circulated this around quite a bit. And now he knows me. He knows how my mother died. He knows everything about me because he used to work for the Central Intelligence Agency. He's not going to publicly state something about me without consulting my dossier. So we're talking about an individual who's been sent on a kamikaze raid, a human kamikaze raid against me, because basically they must have known that by his attacking me, that it was auto-destructive in terms of argument, that whatever he's brought up, I can certainly answer anything he says. So they would only have sent him on this mission because he's about 70 years old now. And at the time that I really was dealing with his personnel records, and I certainly would never expose anything of threat to national security or anything that wasn't in public domain from them on the air. But at the time that I encountered his personnel records, I was with the Department of Defense, and this was around the year of 1988, and he was 45 years old at that time, the exact same age that I am now. And that's just when he began to propagandize about UFOs. And his father, of course, was the owner of the Lear Siegler Corporation, which is a very large defense contractor. So we're talking about somebody who is system all the way. And what he wrote just recently was that Dietrich is a Navy disinformation agent. He mixes up Tonopah Test Range with Area 51. His story about the flag on the Missouri at the end of World War II is incorrect, and his story about a Japanese dirigible blimp over Los Angeles in 1942 is impossible. Japan dropped all lighter-than-air research and activities in 1936. They did not have the expertise to build anything that big or even a place to build it. Not to mention, how do you navigate 5,500 miles between Tokyo and Los Angeles without being able to see the sun or stars? That's 110 hours flight time just to get there, then about 180 hours to get back, headwinds, in parentheses. Then you are going to need a lot of fuel and food. But most of all, during the Battle of L.A. in 1942, we fired 2,000 rounds of 12-pound high explosive shells, which, according to witnesses, just bounced off the target. They would obviously not bounce off of a balloon, so the story is malarkey. And the Nazis going to Antarctica after World War II is old news. Most of them came to the U.S., and after taking over NASA, took over many other large U.S. corporations, and secretly allied with Israel, control the U.S. The Antarctica operation today is huge. The reason for the Holocaust myth, and he says that very pointedly in quotation marks, is to prevent anybody thinking they, Nazi/Jewish people, would ever be allied. Dietrich is just another Navy disinformation guy trying to steer the public knowledge away from the alien craft at Roswell. So this is a mind-bending, shattering public pronouncement and series of accusations to make. I can certainly answer in excruciating detail everything that he's brought up. And basically, he is more than slandering and defaming my character. So I certainly need to point out that fact. To accuse someone of being a disinformation agent in the alternative information media and community is certainly an incredible statement to make, an extraordinary claim, needs extraordinary backing. And he obviously, for some reason, has affiliated me with the United States Navy. And that would be the first interesting statement that he makes, that I'm another Navy disinfo guy. The other one, I'm assuming, the only other one in alternative information media that I can think of, would be George Norrie, because he was a public relations officer for the United States Navy for 9 years. So he must be accusing George Norrie and myself in tandem. But aside from that, we can address that as the show goes on, but we should get into the meat of zombism, unless you want me to address some of these questions first, because I fear if I start addressing some of these questions, it might take up some bit of time. But we've got 3 hours, but we can see what we can.
Well, the reason why I mentioned it about this way is that it can be grouped together, so it could be used in and of itself as a refutation that may be shared, rather than having to dig through the show to get it, though. Of course, people wanting to listen to the show will listen to the show either way.
Right.
So, and one thing I want to bring up just from listening to it, I don't know, he might be just doing this on his own, too, because I've looked into John Lear's work over the years. I used to be kind of excited to hear the stuff, but when I actually followed it up with the towers on the moon and whatnot, and some of the pictures on his website that were supposed to be so obvious to support him, I wasn't too convinced. And the thing that really got me convinced that I don't believe what he says is the jump room to Mars that claimed in 66 that they were able to walk through a portal into Mars. A lot of people believe this, but I've yet to see any evidence for this other than people say, well, I got inside sources, which to me, you might as well be getting it from alien channeling, because if you give me an inside source and nothing else, it's meaningless. Inside source could lead to evidence that can support what the inside source is saying, and I don't have any proof of that. But he might just be doing it on his own, because his approach would be affected by what you are saying. His own paradigm plus his own marketing?
I don't think so at all, because the reality is that John Lear is part of the old boys network of Lieutenant Colonel, and he may have retired, a full Colonel, Kevin Randall, and of course we have Stanton Friedman, and we had Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. Now, these are all men who are government, and hardcore government, government contracts, military consignments. These are basically commissioned officer class or full-blown commissioned physicists, and in his case, he was with the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, they've operated together for quite some time, and what they've chosen to do since I first begun to try and do what I could to inform the public, initially the Japanese public back in the mid-1990s, and then the American public starting in 2008, moving up to 2010 was about the first year, or 2009 was about the first year that I dared to speak to the American public about the Roswell incident. Now, since the 2009 through until this very moment, I've been totally ignored by all of those individuals I mentioned. They just pretend I do not exist. So, and that would have served them quite effectively, but to suddenly come out in the open and make an accusation like this, it's definitely something that comes from their handlers, because nothing they do is without their handlers. They're still totally commissioned. They're still totally employed. They're still on consignment or on contract, because that's how they make their living. And so in terms of an example for him as to why You mentioned the evidence and the evidential facts about why you've kind of turned off to a lot of what he says. All he had to do when people asked him about me was to say, I can't speak to that. But no, he chose an attack. And the reality is, when he started this, when he was 45 years old, the same age I am now, he had four daughters, lived in Las Vegas, Nevada, with his wife, Marilee, a former actress. He had two very young children. Allison was 14 years old and Jacqueline was 10 at the time. And all of this is in public domain. There's nothing that I'm saying that is in any way, shape, or form private business of his. And all of them are still alive, to my knowledge. Certainly none of them were killed violently on the basis of what he said. Now, he knows that all of my family is dead. He knows every single member of my family is dead, anyone that I care for. He knows my mother died under very mysterious circumstances. He's well aware of this. And he knows she died as a direct result of Roswell and the Rising Sun, the DVD that I produced. I came home to find her on the floor dying, and it took her months to die in the most painful and excruciating manner. And she basically, as the doctor said, when they imaged her, they'd never seen anything like it. Her aorta, the main vein leading to her heart, was, as they said, dissected in two places, almost as if it had been a laser scalpel. It was so fine, so well cut, the pressure of the blood going through that main vein was leaking out at very large rates, very rapid rates, into her stomach, into her chest cavity, everywhere else. She was in excruciating agony and pain with that blood pumping out. And that was the night I called for a prayer session. I actually got onto Coast to Coast AM. I asked George Noy to please call for a prayer for my mother. And it must have helped because she lasted for a few more months. The pain slowed down. For some reason, just miraculously, the doctor said she should have died immediately. She lasted until March 19th. At the exact same date that Annie Jacobson released her book, Area 51. And so that's the day that she died, again under mysterious circumstances, in the facility that I had installed her in an attempt to rehabilitate her so that we could get her strong enough where I could try and advocate for a stent to be implanted to block up those dissections. And the end result was I was given a forewarning, and now they pay the price because I have nothing left to lose. And I don't care whether I live or die, and I certainly have collateral. And when I do die, then the information I have that I've hidden up to this point will be let loose on the world from a number of different sources, and they will regret the day they were born, a number of individuals involved. So whether they're just trying to bait me at this point with seeing how far I'll go, how far they can go, they certainly have brought up something that it deserves to be answered in the most gentlemanly, debating fashion. Certainly, everybody's heard about John Lear. He's this super stud in the airplanes. He's won all these awards. He's held every single license the FAA has ever awarded. He's won races, everything. And he was in Vietnam in 1966, the year that I was born. Now, what I need to ask is he's such a hotshot pilot. Why did we lose August 1967's air battle? I mean, this war in Vietnam that he was in produced two American ace fighter pilots. That means each one of them had more than five aerial kills. The North Vietnamese produced 16 combat aces, including Nguyen Van Cock, the top ace of the war with nine kills in Vietnam. And on August 23rd of 1967, Cock led several MIG fighters to intercept a group of 40 American aircraft on a bombing mission. They shot down three American F-4D fighters and one F-105D fighter bomber without losing a single MIG. Eight American aviators were killed or captured. This went on throughout the war. That's how the hotel, the Hanoi Hilton, filled up so fast. Well, what was he doing? He was basically working for the CIA, flying in cargo for General Vang Pao and his CIA-supported troops. And since he's flying for Air America, what was that? It was the largest civilian airlines on the planet Earth. You could put together TWA. You could put together Pan Am. You could put together every single airline in the world that came up to a fraction of the CIA airlines. And who was in charge of Air America, the CIA airlines? Air Force General Secord. And Richard Secord basically was running the largest drug smuggling operation on Earth. So we're talking about a CIA bagman by his own admission. And by his own admission, this man represents certainly a moral platform that is hardly commendable. And when he attacks someone who has lost his family to what I've been pursuing. This is what I have to say to every single one of those men, whether it's Philip Corso, whether it's Stanton Friedman, whether it's Kevin Randall, whether it's John Lear. If you're telling the truth, you're going to be coming home to dead relatives. Now, every single one of them comes home to relatives that are alive and well. And he grew up rich and spoiled, able to play with yachts, able to play with all this plane racing. He had a daddy who built the Learjet, in charge of a defense contracting industry. He can play these little games, and he thinks he can get away with it. Well, I came from dirt poverty. I grew up in absolute filth. I grew up with rats gnawing on my ears when I woke up. And I'm not exaggerating. So I want to let him know that whatever world he lived in, where he goes to Vietnam and flies in drugs and dope and flies it back to America and then plays these little alien games, every single one of his questions I can answer. And I can answer that before a friendly debate. And they should be answered before a friendly debate. Because at that time that we get to some discussion as to why he's saying what he's doing, at that point, I really think we'll be talking about any number of other issues that are publicly accessible.
All right, well, let me just stop in here. I offer this to happen, but here's what I want to say is when I don't know what the word is, referee or chair or moderate, I guess moderate a debate. Right. What I will insist upon is that the person answer the question that's given to him. One of my complaints with debates, the reason why I don't have too many things going on here where I have two opposing parties is that most things I see is simply either non sequiturs or avoiding it and bringing up, you did this. Oh, yeah, well, you did that. Well, yeah, well, you did this, which, you know, does not answer the question. So and I doubt very much he'll go along with this. But if he does, I would just want to say that up front. I also want to say that, and I forgot what I was going
to
say.
Just to clarify, don't worry, we'll get back on track with that. Just to clarify, one of the things he accused me of is mixing up Tonopah Army Airfield with Nellis Air Force Base, also known as Area 51. Well, that's just patently absurd, because remember that the documents I was dealing with were old documents.
Right, actually, let me just butt in here, sure you can remember better than I can, is that he's saying you're some kind of disinformation agent for the government, and yet what you're bringing out is very incriminating to the government. Why would the government employ you to disseminate information which would make them look bad?
Well, beyond that,
I know it's
so
simple,
long?
But it's a pretty simple base kind of problem that one would have with his accusations.
Oh, absolutely. That's the big problem. You see, when he talks about aliens at Roswell, it all goes back to World War II. Keep in mind that the American government, what they're willing to kill for, is the fact that they lost the war. They lost the war to a species, as they considered it, the Japanese, that they considered to be subhuman. Now, remember that the Department of Justice had been in charge of what they called the enemy alien problem. That was the term that was used. Enemy alien problem. Very similar to the Third Reich's employment of the term Untermensch, or Untermann, for subhuman. And the enemy alien problem from December to February 19th, when Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, was underneath Department of Justice. Then it went to the U.S. Army, which was the father branch of service for the U.S. Army Air Corps, which became the U.S. Army Air Force and ultimately the Air Force. This is where we get into Nellis Air Force Base, Area 51, Tonopah Army Airfield, becoming just Tonopah Airfield. All of it on a map is one gray area. Now, why is it all one gray area on the map along with S4, where Bob Lazar worked and which they claim don't exist? Because it's all interconnected by underground tunnels. Now, aside from all that, it's all interconnected by cross-administration. So there is no mix-up. I dealt with the original documents. The original documents were U.S. Army documents because there was no Air Force and there was no CIA. And in 1947, two branches of service were born, the United States Air Force and the Central Intelligence Agency, as a direct result, both of them, from the collateral damage of the Roswell incident from World War II and the exploitation of Japanese prisoners of war referred to just as they referred to the Japanese-American U.S. citizens that they interned, over 124,000 of them, enemy aliens. And in terms of these prisoners of war and their exploitation, we're talking major war crimes, and the atrocities they committed did not help the Americans win. The end result is they're dying to hide their war crimes. They're dying to hide the fact that they lost. And the end result is they'll come up with any ridiculous thing they can say. But it keeps going back to aliens. They want you to believe in the alien myth. And it's like I said, Battle of Los Angeles, the movie Independence Day. What do they say? In Independence Day, you've got actual pilots, military pilots flying those planes. They're not computer graphics. And you've got actual Marine Corps pilots flying the helicopters in Battle of Los Angeles. It's not computer graphics. The military is backing these films up with tremendous firepower because these films are saying something the military wants them to say. They want to say there's aliens at Area 51 as opposed to the bodies of Japanese prisoners of war, who the Americans considered to be entirely subhuman. And it goes back to this constant claim that the Japanese did not have the technology to cross the Pacific. It's just preposterous. We could go into that.
But actually, you know, one thing you did say about that was that how could they travel all that way without seeing the sun or the stars? But that I don't understand, because when you go up in the air and above the clouds, that's all you see is sun and stars. So I didn't understand that reference.
Well, he might be claiming that if it's high enough in the stratosphere that there may not be an atmosphere in which the stars will twinkle. Or there, I don't know what his logic is. There's plenty of logic leaps that this individual comes up with, and all of them are preposterous. And we can certainly go into that in detail. The problem is that it actually requires an entire show, which I'm happy.
Maybe that's something we can cover at that point. You know, right. if we don't hear back from John, and if he does continue publicly saying things, then I would feel no problem with giving you a show to refute that, since he won't deal with it. You know, it doesn't have to be me. I mean, it could be anywhere. I'm just saying that if there's not if someone's going to snipe at these, do these things despicably, then someone can, in the court of in public opinion, bring out facts and show that this is ridiculous.
Well, he is certainly obligated, since he made the acquisition, to bring up naval records. He has to bring up whatever connections I have that he claims I have with the Office of Naval Intelligence, whichever department of the Navy that he is affiliating me with, such as George Norrie's former department, the Public Relations Department. So that is an absolutely bizarre attack, and I assume he's taken a snipe at my father, who spent over 30 years in the Navy and over three wars in the Navy, when he makes a claim like that. But in terms of trying to read the mind of someone like this, best answer some of what he says as soon as possible, and we'll see if we have any time left later in the show. What we'll cover is some of the conditions of zombism that are affecting us in America's urban environment at this point, and then when we cover some of the basics of that, we can kind of return to some of these questions, because I believe it is important to answer them now, because unfortunately, once the acquisition's brought up, once the friendly invitation to basically a discussion is brought up, it, almost certainly there's not going to be an answer. And if there's not an answer, then my ability to answer these questions becomes almost a moot point. If it's done a few weeks later, when you don't strike while the iron is hot in answering some of these questions, people forget what was asked, and people forget what the big deal is. And he's not going to say anything again. After what I brought up tonight, if he says anything again, based on the sensitivity of what he's already said, he may incriminate himself to the point of something serious. So his handlers will probably, I'm sure, shut him up. I don't believe his handlers are going to allow him to say any more.
Well, that'll be interesting to see, too, you know, because that also would tell you something. If he won't address it, then maybe somebody said he struck back a little bit too hard, or he struck back unexpectedly with too much data, you know, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, and, well, I need to hit him in the – I'll slap him in the face with some of our data tonight. But we'll address something that is an emergent problem in our inner cities, which is the zombie psychosis. And just to clarify some of the three ways of entering into the condition of zombism that you mentioned, we can address, of course, the bath salts first and exactly what it is about them that is so pertinent. Certainly, one of the original doctors, actual modern MDs educated in the United States to study the phenomenon of zombism as a in Haiti was Dr. Nathan S. Klein. And Dr. Klein was a prominent psychopharmacologist. He was the only two-time winner of the Albert Lasker Award for Clinical Medical Research. And this award is known as America's Nobel Prize. And it was he who, with Manfred Kleins, co-coined the term cyborg back in 1960. And they first used the phrase in an article published in Astronautics magazine about the advantages of self-regulating humanic machine systems in outer space. Now, the reason he went to Haiti and was affiliated with medical practice in Haiti for 30 years was because he was studying the Paul Zombie, or the zombie powder, that created the condition of zombism in Haiti. This is an aspect which most people are totally unfamiliar with. They're aware, of course, of the ethnobotanist Edmund Wade Davis, who came to Haiti, and ultimately the movie The Serpent and the Rainbow, as well as a book by that name, was written about Edmund Wade Davis. Well, the reason he arrived in Haiti was at the behest of Dr. Klein to study the zombie phenomena. And it has to be remembered that both of these doctors were engaging in something that can only be declared as highly illegal. It has to be remembered that to manufacture or reanimate or create a zombie in Haiti is entirely illegal. One would hope it would be legal anywhere in the world, but the majority of the rest of the world does not acknowledge the existence of such phenomena. And this is why when Wade Davis went to several Vuhudunita and Bokor or Yungons, Mambos, various practitioners of what in America is known as voodoo, he basically purchased no less than 8 samples of palzombi, or zombie powder, from several different practitioners of voodoo in 4 separate regions of Haiti. And because it is against the law, amongst their other narcotics laws, to deal in the zombie powder, Edmund Wayne Davis is essentially a drug smuggler. And when he brought it back to the United States, it was analyzed by pharmacological labs. Now, the reason that it was originally such a fascinating powder for Dr. Klein was because he was working with astronautics. And since he was working with astronautics and had co-coined the term cyborg, self-regulating humanic machine systems, the reason that the zombie powder was so important to him was because this was something that obviously brought people to the brink of death where they flatlined and they could be reanimated. So this would not be only invaluable to the field of anesthesiology, where 50,000 patients a year die of anesthetic shock. It could also be used to induce a coma in astronauts for long-term space flights and bring them back at the other end of their journey and then put them in again for a return journey. This would be a profound impact to the industry with which he was directly affiliated. And no doubt it's gone undercover because certainly it's never reached the our operating table at all. 50,000 patients a year still die of anesthetic shock. So that means it's gone into black budget. It's gone into the defense contracting, or what was picked up by Edmund Wade Davis and brought back to the United States. As for Dr. Klein himself, he died very mysteriously that year that Edmund Wade Davis came onto the island of Haiti. Very untimely death, and the reasons behind that are still in question or under investigation. The last I heard, maybe something new has been found. But keep in mind, I was dealing with documents from that period of time and have not been keeping track of them since. But how does that impact what we're dealing with today in terms of this phenomena that recently happened in Miami? Well, basically, there's a affiliate of mine who is a writer of historic fiction, and he wrote the book Heroes of the Fallen. His name is David West. It was a novel, and certainly people are free to investigate David West and his work through his own blogspot. But David J. West, actually, while struggling as a writer, worked in the legal drug industry, this gray area of manufacturing narcotics that ultimately led to the manufacture of bath salts. Now, it's important to emphasize the fact that he himself was not involved with the manufacture or the packing of bath salts. As a matter of fact, he walked off the job in direct repugnance and moral rejection of packing the bath salts. And also, he felt really uncomfortable wearing the rubberized hazmat suit. But aside from that, he was initially packing what was known as spice. Spice was manufactured. All of these drugs are manufactured by Pakistani chemists. They're by Muslim chemists in the United States. And these Muslim chemists come over to the United States. They're highly educated in terms of chemistry, and they work in seedy tenements. They rent entire blocks or entire abandoned warehouses. They manufacture the chemical synthetic equivalent of illegal drugs in such a way that they are legal because they are not yet tested or even recognized. To give an example,
isn't what they term designer drugs? I mean, that's the entire phrase means that they've designed around the illegal configuration while still getting some kind of effect.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing up that cogent point.
Yeah.
And what makes the bath salts dangerous is the fact that they don't even have a drug test to show if someone is using bath salts. In other words, there's such a new designer drug in terms of the state or the law enforcement authorities or the normal human society recognizing them that there is not yet a test in place to test whether someone is using bath salts. The only way you can know is if someone admits to it. If they don't cop to it, I have no idea whether a coroner can actually tell it's in there. There are poisons and toxins which a coroner cannot recognize unless a coroner is looking for a specific kind of poison or toxin. In certain cases, he's not going to find them unless he's on the alert for them. And in some cases, he can't find them at all, whether he's on the alert for them or not. And so the important thing to remember about this is there's no test for these drugs. Now, the chemical mixture, the composite, was actually synthesized for what is known today as bath salts in 1960. The designer drug status was reached around 2004, but it only became emergent on the market as we recognize it today in late 2010. That was when my friend David J. West, the writer of Heroes of the Fallen and a number of other writings, was basically packing at the time spice, which was synthetic marijuana. And spice was essentially very thin strips of treated paper. Like, it was like acid. People used to take tabs of acid on treated paper. So what the Pakistani Muslim chemists did was they took very thin paper and they treated it instead with synthetics that would emulate the effects of THC. And they would sell it as an incense. And they would warn people, this is not for inhalation or ingestion. This is incense, not for recreational inhalation. And, of course, they'd sell it to everyone knowing full well they're going to take that entire mulch, this entire artificial mulch packs that they were selling and just smoke it to get the high. And when that became illegal, they started transferring over to the manufacturer of bath salts. That's when David J. West walked out of work, even though he had a wife and three kids to feed. And he would not morally stand for what bath salts were capable of. Also, you can absorb them topically through the skin or inhale them and have profound effects, just as what was seen in Miami. So he was very afraid for his health and his sanity, his biochemical balance at that point. And the kind of rubberized hazmat suits the Pakistanis were supplying were just cut rate, manufactured in the Soviet Union. And the Workers' Paradise was famous for creating these kinds of suits that had holes in the seams that during warfare practice, during military exercises, where they were playing war games in the Soviet Union, they would unleash lethal toxic nerve gas, and thousands of their own troops would die due to these chemical suits not being up to snuff, not being functional, lacking efficacy in terms of their protective barriers. So who would want to work with that in their right minds? Even the most desperate of people would be better off begging for money on the streets. But in terms of what this drug is and what was going on with it, it is known as mephedrone. And basically, it is essentially known by its acronym as MDVP. And MDVP is essentially a short condensation, an acronym for methylenediox the pyrovalerone. And basically, it is an artificial drug that has never been analogous to any existing drug. It is truly a designer drug. So its effects are not meant to emulate any known drug in existence. And the end result is, what's made it so dangerous is it's become tainted. In Miami, due to the huge Cubano population of immigrants, with Polzombi, or the zombie powder. And in terms of its long-term effects, let me put it into perspective for you.
Well, actually, let's this is the music going, so it's time to break. Maybe it's a good time to just stop here, and we will come with the perspective. Now, what happens is I stop for about a 10-minute report on This Week in Free Energy with Sterling Allen. So I will call you back at the top of the hour, and then we'll have the remaining 2 hours, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
So I'll give you a call back. All righty. Douglas Dietrich, he is now become renowned for his well-delivered continual flow of information. It makes it very easy as a host to go through that. So we'll be back to continue with him in a little bit. But first, Sterling Allen, This Week in Free Energy. Most people think of addictions relating to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. However, obsessive-compulsive actions taken to excessive levels have the same biochemical goal. They stimulate the creation of natural feel-good hormones, but at a cost that causes more harm in the long run. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com.
What does hurricanes, cyclones, tornadoes, blizzards, floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, civil unrest, martial law, and even the passage of Planet X have in common? The loss of electrical power. And when you stop to think about it, what aspect of our lives is not dependent on electricity? Time to think about solar and wind energies. Solar Sphere offers you a wide selection of solar-powered gadgets, chargers, and complete panel systems. And the Home Wind Company offers complete wind power from the smallest to the largest electrical needs, including do-it-yourself kits. Simply meander over to our website at feet2fire.com and look at the solar gadgets and the wind turbine ads and click your way to take back your power from the whims of weather, disaster, and politics. Generators only last as long as you have fuel. So turn to the sun at Solar Sphere and turn to the wind at Home Wind.
Thanks for listening to Feet to the Fire with host James Arthur Jancic. Join James Sunday evenings at 9:53 Eastern Time for This Week in Free Energy, a weekly update regarding current developments in the clean, free, and renewable energy sector. To check out archived episodes of This Week in Free Energy, log on to www.freeenergynews.com. Brought to you by the Open Source Energy Network.
There's not going to be a This Week in Free Energy. Sterling's not online. I don't know what happened. It is possible he forgot that we moved to Friday. He is human, so that could be possible. We've been there for a few weeks now, but, you know, that's probably what I'm guessing. I'm hoping he's not injured or hurt or anything. So, I mean, I'd rather have that be the reason than something else. So I've just called Douglas right back. And Douglas,
yes,
I guess we'll just keep going right from here. I'm glad you were available. I didn't like step out for something for a minute, though. I'm sure I could have filled the time with something, something very valuable and newsworthy, off the top of my head. Right. But I would rather hear what you have to say, frankly. So why don't we just pick it up where you left off?
Absolutely, and thank you for this opportunity. What I was talking about was the Pan-American practice of wuhudong. and also known in the northern nations as voodoo. And the reason that this is so important is because it's 60 million people practice it worldwide, both in Pan America and across the Atlantic in Africa. And most Americans and northerners, meaning anyone in Europe or in Russia, etc., these are cultures which normally, other than in intelligence units or police units, such as in the Soviet Union, which wound up exploiting the techniques or the apothecary of synthesized pudzombi, the zombie powder, aside from the Soviets synthesizing it and probably the Americans doing so covertly, as a matter of fact, guaranteed they're doing so covertly, basically the vast majority of the public knows nothing about voodoo and the techniques of voodoo, which have made voodoo so potent in history and made it such a mover and a shaker in history, in which, in a way which northerners do not appreciate but should. And these 60 million people have manifested different forms of voodoo, and in Cuba it's known as arashengo, and it has various other names. In Brazil it's candomblé. But as more and more emigres come from the South into Cubans, into Miami, Puerto Ricans, into New York City, Mexicanos, into Los Angeles, what you get is an exponential growth of the practice of voodoo. And the practice of voodoo has led to the spread of the pudzombi, and it has tainted the bath salts. And no doubt this was done intentionally, because we have to remember that the Pakistani chemists, the street chemists as they are known, who are manufacturing these designer drugs, are in a very gray area where what they're doing they consider to be a part of the war effort to bring down Christianity and the infidel. So they feel that what they are doing is part of the struggle of Islam against the decadent infidel, and to taint the bath salts with pudzombi is part of a strategy. It is part of a military insurgency. And I'm saying this on the air for the first time, so if we get taken off the air, I want everyone to know this, why. No one.
Well, we've already had a hard time, so I don't know if they read your mind or not, but my server is being pounded by something, and I had to go do an end run here, which took most of the first hour. And so, right. You know, I normally don't go for that, because it's a quick way for talk show hosts to feel important by saying, well, you know, it's they're coming to get me. But Woody Allen had a line once that said, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you. So.
Well, keep in mind, I have collateral, and what we're getting out is something that I think the well-educated American citizen would have a hard time, forget education. The well-informed, street-smart, common-sense American citizen would have a hard time getting this information in a line where he could understand the strategic implications of it, whereas the overeducated American probably wouldn't want to understand it at all. But in terms of the paragraph found on Tumblr considering the bath salts, it's just simply ridiculous. They actually say something to the effect of the Drug Enforcement Administration's forensic monitoring system found two reports of MDPV in 2009. In 2010, that figure jumped to 338 cases. Between January through September 2011, the number skyrocketed to 911 MDPV cases spanning 34 states. Now, think of the bizarre occult nature of that last statement. September 2011, 911 cases of MDPV. Very bizarre. But yeah. Beyond that, what's simply going on is basically MDPV has been used for years, since 2004, but it's only recently it's become tainted with the pudzombi, and therefore the zombie pharmacosis. So that is.
So where does it? Where does this drug come from, and what is it? What is it? You know, what is it? What's it purported to do?
Well, the drug obviously is made here. So when you say where does it
come from? I take that. That's not how actually what I meant. I mean, where's? I mean, somebody thought of it for somehow. I mean, you know, where's the background of it? So that it came into existence. I mean, do you know how it came into existence? Is it just they happened to be flipping chemicals around and it worked, or is there some kind of methodology to coming up with the drug?
Well, there's certainly a methodology. I'll give you an example of this. It goes back to the Pakistani nation. We've spoken before of the spoiled Muslim princess known as Benazir Bhutto and her absolute inhuman ruthlessness to where she took 20,000 of her own men and bled them dry. We've spoken of this in the past. So you have a very, very hard culture. You have a culture that is completely alien to the nature of Western thinking. And that goes into a lot of the kind of Africanized voodoo culture that that Americans can be exposed to if they happen to be traveling in those circles. Santeria and the rest of these practices of voodoos are actually quite spiritual, and I don't mean, certainly in the case of voodoos, to condemn it as a religious practice, but there are techniques that are abused by negative voodoozinista or practitioners of voodoos that are notoriously evil, such as the exploitation of zombies as slaves without volition or without will. That's what the zombie powder was originally intended to create. Things go terribly wrong when it is mixed with another drug it was not meant to be mixed with. Then you have a feral or a wild zombie. And in terms of the methadrone, the MDVP, we're talking about something that comes from the minds of very determined, ideologically or religiously motivated scientists. I'll give you an example of this, about how they work. When Pakistan invaded, and Pakistan did invade Afghanistan, it was through what was known as the Taliban. The Taliban simply is their word for seminarian, their equivalent of Quran student or a Bible student, as we would call it in the West. Now, where do such seminarians get laser-guided rocket launchers? Where do they get Abrams tanks? Where do they get Hind helicopters? These are incredible assets for students of the Quran to come up with. Well, they were supplied by the Pakistani military. All of the Taliban, which simply means freedom fighter in their language, basically is ISI, or Pakistani CIA. And the ISI invaded Afghanistan to gain control of the opium market in the wake of the retreating Soviets and to gain a strategic position over Kashmir, where Pakistan has been fighting with India through six major wars. And so when they invaded, the first thing that one would notice is many of these people, Taliban, people think of people living in caves, they're flying helicopters. Let me put this into perspective for you. You can train a monkey to fly a spaceship. You can't train a monkey to fly a helicopter. You get people flying jets, that's easy compared to a helicopter. Helicopter is the most difficult thing in the world to fly. There is no air machine more difficult to fly than a helicopter. You can do things a bird can't do in a helicopter. You can fly backwards in a helicopter. And a helicopter is extraordinarily difficult to master. A helicopter pilot is to be admired infinitely more than any mere jet pilot, other than perhaps a naval aviator who's trained to land on the deck of a carrier. And so helicopter pilots who have to land on carriers, as far as I'm concerned, are the best of the best. So if you can't train monkeys to fly a helicopter, and these guys are learning how to do it, they're pretty brilliant. And you find out that these guys, who are part of Al-Qaeda, who wound up working with the Taliban, many of them are getting educated as engineers in Germany. You realize these people aren't stupid. It's just they only apply themselves to whatever leads to war and destruction. They would never become a doctor to learn how to heal anybody, but they'll sure become a scientist to know how to make biological weapons. And that's the kind of mentality that we're talking about. That's where this comes from. This comes from a weaponization of a mentality. Basically, Islamicism is an ideology in the sense that communism was an ideology. modern Islamicism is very definitely a militarized religion with men who are willing to educate themselves and, if you will, for lack of a better term, better themselves in terms of whatever it takes, learning whatever skills it takes to carry out their mission. This is why, again, you get people like John Lear say it's impossible for any pilot to fly these planes into those towers. That may be the case that there was something that was altered or autopiloted, or there might have been something going on with the planes in the towers. But to say that pilots couldn't fly them into the towers, that's ridiculous. Anyone with enough training can fly a plane into a tower. it's like hitting a barn when you're on the inside with a firearm. It's not like it's that difficult to miss.
All right, we got to hold on here. We're going to take a break, and it's top of the hour, so hang in there, and we will come out at the top and continue as we talk to Douglas Dietrich about zombies, etc. Zombies Incorporated. We'll be right back. Hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. It has been around for decades, century, and known for many qualities. The oxygen that is emitted from the H2O2 as it converts into water and oxygen kills bacteria and whatnot. Antiseptics rely on poison, basically, to kill these little critters. But oxygen does the trick, and of course, oxygen is quite friendly to our environment. Also, it's used internally and externally in the body for various health reasons. In fact, if you go to our website at feedtofire.com and look to the left and scroll down, you'll see the ad we have for food-grade, high-quality, 17.5% H2O2. There's a little link for a free PDF that will give you the amazing backup, the history, as well as the tests and proofs for the effectiveness of hydrogen peroxide. It's important to get food-grade hydrogen peroxide because the stuff you buy in a store has preservatives. I've heard things like tin in there, which is definitely something you don't want to put in your mouth. Hydrogen peroxide is incredibly excellent for gum and teeth health. And the best place to do it, we have a link on our webpage to a source that I have. It's in a 17.5% bottle, which makes it shippable without any kind of hazmat problems, storable, refrigerated, if you want to keep it in the bottle. And then you could break it down into various concentrations to be used internally, externally, etc. That is where the PDF comes in, and also their website has all kinds of help files on it. So if you'd like to know more about the H2O2 hydrogen peroxide, food-grade hydrogen peroxide, you can click on our links there and go to H2O2 food-grade hydrogen peroxide webpage. It's going back to nature and finding out those time-proven principles that show the foolishness of using toxic chemicals. Just click on a link to learn more and to order. Make sure you tell them you heard about them on Feet to the Fire.
Are you getting your greens? I'm James Othiancic, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. In today's busy world, greens often consist of the lettuce on a fast food hamburger. And even people who are health conscious and drink high quality pre or post workout protein shakes miss their greens all the same. Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Inner Food by Inner Health Botanicals. Inner Food promotes health and boosts energy with nature's finest superfoods. Inner Food is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Inner Foods helps you fight an acidic body pH, which has been shown to lead to poor health and even cancer. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Inner Food is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, feedtofire.com, and click on any Enter Health Botanical banner and you're ready to order. Enter Food, building health from the insides out.
It seems like some left of my human side is slowly changing in me.
Will you give it to me?
Looking at my own reflection,
when suddenly it changes, violently it changes.
Oh no, there is no turning back now. Woken up the demon
in me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let them know what I make. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fuck, I get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given to me.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Jancic.
All right, we are back talking about zombieism. Talk about as sickness as you can get. Going insane and not only killing, but eating people. And as crazy and as science fiction as that sounds, turns out to be based in reality. Surprise, surprise. And with us here talking about this, amongst other things, a tangential, is Douglas Dietrich. And welcome back to the show, Douglas.
Thank you.
One second before we go, I just happened to check my email, and somebody had a question about the why didn't the Japanese hydrogen-filled blimps explode when they were hit by artillery fire?
Oh, because they were so large that it doesn't work that way. Where somebody, first off, they weren't hit by artillery fire. These were anti-aircraft rounds, and they were not incendiary rounds. Many of them were unable to even reach the dirigibles. This is where he's making a fallacious statement. See, what's happened is, if you compare the original witness reports of the Battle of Los Angeles, such as the actual police reports, where the police reported Japanese planes shot down on street addresses. For instance, at 185th Street and Vermont Avenue, a Japanese plane was shot down. So these were legitimate attacks that the very next day, it happened on February 24th through the 25th, and the headlines of the morning of the 25th said L.A. area raided and Jap planes attack Santa Monica, Seal Beach, El Segundo, Redondo, Long Beach, Hermosa, Signal Hill. These were parasite fighters. Parasite fighters were released by the dirigible.
Oh, I see.
This is where it becomes so incredible.
Well, that's right. If they had planes attacking in there, how did they get there? They can't fly across the whole Pacific.
That's correct.
So,
and this is, the Americans developed it first. The Americans developed, this is what's so asinine, and you know that our friend John Lear knows exactly that this is what happened.
Now, your anger is not at the questioner. You're talking about John Lear, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I just want to make that sure. So he's listening out there going, hey, I just asked a question. Okay, go ahead.
No, understood. Yeah. And I don't mean it to be taken that way. And I'm sure that on basis of what we discussed so far, I would hope that they don't take it that way.
I just wanted to throw it out there just to be safe. Okay.
Right. Yeah, the asininity lies with John Lear's stance on basis of the fact that as a pilot and as a CIA operative, he knows better. He knows everything that I'm saying. And that's what makes his covering up a war crime and a series of war crimes so heinous and so criminal. There's no other word for it. And the man has no sense of moral fiber to take the stance that he does. None of those men who take that stance do. They truly are evil people. And in terms of what he is saying about, oh, the it just bounced off, nobody ever said anything bounced off those dirigibles at the Battle of Los Angeles. Quite the opposite. They couldn't see the rounds hitting the dirigibles. Some that they did see hit, they were able to say that it looked like it hit it, but to no effect. And again, these were not artillery rounds. They couldn't get that high. Most of the rounds missed and actually fell back down to kill people in Los Angeles itself. And planes were shot down, but the dirigibles remained high enough. They missed the vast majority of the shelling. Whenever they did get hit, most of the time, because they had so many balloons within the major balloon shell, the gas shell, the hydrogen balloons that were hit, because they're not hit by incendiary rounds, doesn't blow. It punctures the balloon. The Japanese can run around inside of the balloons, the crewmen, and they patch it up. And those that were so well riddled they couldn't patch them up, they just dropped them at sea. They had so many balloons within the composite system, they could easily make it back across the Pacific. So that should answer the question in its most basic sense.
Yeah.
But I'll be happy to go into excruciating detail at a later point. If not this show, then another show.
Right, right. Well, we do want to keep on track with the zombie, right. Our trek through zombieism here.
Yes. And in terms of the Paul Zombie, basically it's made of a bewildering variety of deadly plants, which vary a great deal regionally. It includes the ground-up remains of human cadavers, particularly female cadavers, because the estrogen was calculated by herbalists of the Vuhuduns faith to make men much more placid and much more prone towards obeying orders. And the skin of poisonous tree frogs, millipedes, tarantulas, all these biotoxic irritants. Finally, the main ingredient in the overwhelming majority of zombie powders is tetrodotoxin. And that's TTX, found in the spiny dermis of the needle bristling skin of toxic pufferfish, known as the crepal de mer. Off the Haitian coastline, known as fugu in Japanese restaurants. Now, you might ask, why don't all Japanese people eating fugu who get that kind of poisoning become zombies? Well, obviously, they're not taking it in with this enormous mixture of potency and various other codependent kind of chemicals that create the Paul Zombie as we've come to understand it. Now, in terms of this Paul Zombie, what made it so decisive in terms of history is because it brings people to a flatlining level, and then you can bring them back. But that's only if you desire to bring them back. If you don't administer what they call the resurrection potion, which basically is based on the zombie's cucumber, and the cucumber zombie, as it's known in Haiti, is basically data stramonium. And data stramonium basically is a kind of plant that induces hallucinations, a sleepwalking type state. And we can get into that later in the show if we need to. It's kind of peripheral to what we're talking about right now.
Right, okay.
I fear I may have mispronounced it terribly. but aside from that, to give you an example of why this is so important in America, what does this mean for us? Well, it was rumored.
Actually, can I interrupt for 1 second? There was a question that came in and said, ask him if this is the same powder they used in what was portrayed in the movie Serpent in the Rainbow.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have to remember that the movie Serpent in the Rainbow was tediously insipid, yet somehow critically acclaimed. Certainly didn't have much to do with the book, and the book itself was so overblown that Edmund Wade Davis was excoriated by the professional community of academicians, whether they were anthropologists or chemists or ethnobotanists or the like. And he could no longer take the sneers of his contemporaries and was forced to release an academic book called The Ethnobotany of the Haitian Zombie. And it was in this book that everything was footnoted, everything was sourced, and he basically rendered the chemical composition of everything that he was dealing with in such a way as to make it totally inaccessible to the reading public other than for professionals. That is the book that someone would want to investigate if they were attempting to manufacture a zombie of their own or an army of such. I should have said that on air. But at any rate, Moving right along, in terms of how does this affect us in the United States, Theresa Marie Schindler, also known as Terry Schiavo, she was the husband of medical specialist Michael Schiavo. And again, this is reputedly, I have to say this to cover myself legally, he was reputedly abusive. And what had happened was that, according to anonymous ethnobotanical sources, all of the symptoms that she was suffering from in terms of her catatonic state was allegedly potentially due to the administration of Paltombi. And ultimately, she was thanatized per her husband's wishes. Now, there's no evidence of this that could convict him that I know of. So I'm not accusing him of this. These are reputedly, allegedly educated guesses on the part of ethnobotanists who want to remain anonymous. But obviously, she was in a permanent vegetative state via oxygen deprivation to the brain, exactly the symptoms of these various applications of Paltombi, and some very, very similar to them.
So now, do these people die if they're not brought out, or are they preserved in some way until a certain date?
Basically, they can last for a surprising amount of time without oxygen because they are indeed not breathing. They are truly flatlining. And I will give you an example of this. They basically will register by all modern medical technology as dead. And that is what makes this so incredibly frightening. People don't understand that. It's not like if you're in the United States, you're going to escape. Oh, those people in Haiti just don't have the imaging technology that we have in the United States. Well, I'll give you an example of this where someone had all of the imaging technology, and that was a automobile accident victim who was ultimately saved due to his doctor using ultra-modern imaging technology to read areas of his brain that nobody else was even willing to look at. And I'll have to look through my notes to find out that individual's name, because he was actually in Belgium, and it was a Belgian doctor who prevented his parents. His parents were kind enough not to pull the plug when it was recommended that they do so, because their son was legally brain dead. What had happened was they decided to wait and wait. And the man's name, as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, the neurologist was Dr. Stephen Lowrys. His last name was spelled Laurey. And this patient, if I can remember his name correctly, I believe it was Rom Houben, Rom, R-O-M, and Houben spelled H-O-U-B-E-N. And he was diagnosed back in 1983 as clinically dead, a persistent vegetative state with extinct consciousness. And it wasn't until just a few years ago, literally 2009, that Dr. Stephen Lowrys was able to prove that he could hear, he could feel, he could see all that was going on around him, and he constantly heard his parents crying, the doctors pronouncing him clinically dead, and he could hear for years the doctors advocating the pulling of the plug. Imagine that level of torture. We're talking about from, as I said, a good 20 years of living like that. And so that's how Terry Schiavo was. And ultimately, it went all the way up to the governor, Jeb Bush, who could have given her a pardon, but no, he sentenced her to death by torture, by dehydration.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Deprived of liquid.
So she's one of those people who had this?
Yes.
I remember that whole thing, and the parents said that they were alive and all that.
Yes, and I'll tell you, what does that mean? Why is that important to us, aside from bringing forth an atrocity, a personal atrocity? Because Terry Schiavo's case is the precedent. She's the legal precedent, which means that anyone, any American, any U.S. citizen exhibiting sufficient brain damage is, from this point forward, legally dead meat. No right to life means no rights, period. The litigious ramifications mean a nationally recognized reinstatement of American slavery and or genocide should anyone decide. That's the strategic motivation behind Dr. Wade Davis's assignment in appropriating and cracking the secrets of Paltombi for the North American medical industrial complex. Never went to the operating table. What's it going to be used for? If you get people brain dead enough, Terry Schiavo style, if it's legal to kill them, it's legal to work them. You could have a slave labor population. Since they're clinically dead, they're not legally enslaved. You have people literally working at that point for food. That is essentially the strategic implications of what I'm talking about. Anyone who considers this paranoid is ignoring history. That's exactly what they were used for throughout the Caribbean, throughout sugarcane plantations in high Brazil. So anyone who says, oh, that can't happen here, it already has. And we don't know what's going on in isolated areas where the U.S. government might be taking prisoners. Obviously, Edmund Wayne Davis was a Canadian, but whoever was employing him, it was at the behest of an American doctor, Dr. Klein. So we're talking about a very, very ominous situation. Now, in terms of how could it be used as a weapon? Well, the original man to brilliantly apply it in terms of war was a man known as Toussaint Louverture. And Toussaint Louverture was the greatest black military hero in modern history. And he was 50 years old when he began to lead his nation into independence. They were the first black republic ever to exist on the planet. It was the Republic of Haiti. It was the second republic to exist in the Western Hemisphere after the United States. And what he did was he took the Pau-Zombie and he found a way to make it stable, like gunpowder. He found a way to administer it to his troops who volunteered to be zombified if they should fall in battle. And that way, if they were able to fall in battle, they had already drank a pinprick, as it was described, in their wine or whiskey or rum rations before the battle. And because of the sugarcane availability in all of Pan America, rum is the preferred drink of choice. And the combination of rum and gunpowder was a pirate's tipple going back to the days of Blackbeard.
Mm-hmm.
Dropping a pinprick of the Pau-Zombie in the rum they drank before a battle enabled them, when they were severely injured, mortally wounded, to go into a catatonic state. Then the application by a field medic, an Ungon, a healer, of more Pau-Zombie reanimated them. Now, the effects of this were cataclysmic to the people who fought Toussaint Louverture. He was fought by no less than the three greatest military empires of his day, Britain, France, and Spain. And in terms of what happened with the British, they basically, first he fought the Spanish, and when he fought them off, then the British tried to take over, and he basically, they landed about 25,000 men in a beachhead, and they suffered more casualties than they would ever suffer again until World War One. To put that into perspective for you, in World War One, 50,000 men could die in a single day. So when 25,000 troops suffered the worst British casualties in history prior to World War One, that's saying quite a bit. And then Napoleon himself decided he was going to retake the island of Haiti. And what Napoleon Bonaparte sent was the largest invasion fleet ever launched by the nation of France to take over Haiti. And literally, there's never been an invasion fleet launched by France that's been that large ever since. And he had his own brother-in-law, General Leclerc, who was there to reinstitute French rule. He had 60,000 men. He had over 60,000 men, and they brought with them bloodhounds imported from Spanish Cuba that were raised to feed only on black-skinned human flesh. Now, four-fifths of this expeditionary force died of yellow fever, spread initially by zombie bite, including 18 of its 50 generals. Soon only 7,000 starving, sickly troops survived to be deported by the British fleet. Think of what I'm saying. The end result was Haiti won its independence. Toussaint Louverture was ultimately betrayed by treachery as opposed to militarily defeated. Men in his own high command for gold turned him over to the French. He was brought over to Fort de Jure in the Jura Mountains, the French Alps, where Napoleon Bonaparte tortured him mercilessly to get the zombie formula. Napoleon Bonaparte had already invaded Egypt. He had a huge colonial force, colored people, that he was going to zombify to march over Europe and the New World. But Toussaint Louverture died without breaking, and Napoleon Bonaparte was left without that war-winning formulary. And because Haiti won its independence, he went broke paying reparations, not to the former slaves, but to the former. And he paid them for loss of their plantations and their slave flesh to the point where, to make up for it and restabilize the French budget, Louisiana Territory to the United States. And because of that, the United States is what it is today. If Toussaint Louverture hadn't defeated Napoleon Bonaparte, hadn't held out from his torture, then the United States would be French. As it was, the Louisiana Territory was sold to the United States for pennies on the dollar, and the United States gained an enormous amount of territory. What was an emaciated Atlantic Republic suddenly gained a hinterland and literally bordered Imperial Russia. Literally bordered Imperial Russia, because they had Alaska all the way down to Northern California back then. So this is the impact of zombies on history, and you know nothing of it. This is what they've managed to hide and occult from you. And how much more have they managed to hide? Well, the Americans, none of this was lost on them. What happened with the victory of Toussaint Louverture? You think the Americans appreciated it? They appreciated the opportunity. And what they did was they declared the Monroe Doctrine, where they claimed all of the Western Hemisphere under President Monroe was to belong to the United States, if you can believe the temerity of that. Now, what happened was they had gained a hold of experience directly with Voodoons in the case of the Battle for Louisiana. And in the battles for Louisiana, they ran into Major General Edmund Kirby Smith, Confederate States Army. Now, he didn't surrender until after Lee at Appomattox. Lee surrendered at Appomattox probably about, if I remember correctly, it was in April of 1865. Well, Kirby Smith held out until the 26th of May, and his troops were still advancing. And he had given the United States Army some of its gravest defeats and disasters in the American Civil War. And the end result was a lot of it was blamed on the Creole population, which were Caucasians, but were Africanized in culture through the belief in Voodoons. And as soon as the war ended and he surrendered his command, he took off with the two governors of Louisiana to seek asylum from Ferdinand Maximilian Joseph I of Mexico, the Mexican emperor. And the United States offered him total amnesty if he would come back and tell them about the Creole population, help them round up these people, get them under control so they could interrogate them for certain secrets concerning Voodoons and the zombie formula. Now, what had happened was, when they interrogated a lot of these people, they got to use it later on when they went to war with Haiti. And what they did was they invaded Navassa Island. And you might ask, well, what's Navassa Island? Why is it so important? Basically, what Navassa Island was is it's a strategic island in the middle of the Caribbean that's underneath Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, right to the, shall we say, the west of Haiti, and right to the east of Jamaica. It's the Hawaii of the Caribbean. It's the most strategic island there. Now, it was discovered in 1509 when Columbus was stranded in Jamaica. He sent crewmen back to the island of Hispaniola, where Haiti and the Dominican Republic exist today, for help. En route, they encountered this island. Over 2 square miles, about 9 times the size of the National Mall in Washington, D.C., a lot of land area, dense fig trees, enough grassland to support goat herds. Whatever took place on their landing caused them to vacate the premises without even stock and water, let alone attempting formalities of claiming it for their Spanish sponsors. Instead, they noted it as Navassa, and they basically recommended avoidance for all mariners. And it was avoided by mariners for the next 300 years. Suddenly, the Haitians of the Black Republic of Haiti colonized it with transitional fishermen who felt that their Voodoons and their faith protected them from whatever had so frightened and repelled the white conquerors. And then it was discovered that there were phosphates on the island. And that's when the United States became interested for strategic reasons and for industrial reasons. And it was lobbied by various industries in the United States that Navassa Island be made part of the United States. even though it was separated from the U.S. coast by several nation states like Cuba, Jamaica, and Haiti. So basically, the Baltimore Fertilizer Company lobbied the United States for the phosphates, and the United States invaded. And in 1857, Marines landed, forced an annexation of Navassa Island, and it's been part of the United States ever since. What's the first thing they did? They brought hundreds of African-American slaves to work the island and dig the phosphates. Slavery was not officially abolished until the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified by the states in 1865. So we're talking 1857. And they had known of Uhudun even before the American Civil War, made use of it, apparently, because those slaves were later on supposedly zombified by the U.S. government, and they locked them up on the island and threw away the key. Later on, when they invaded Haiti, literally invaded in years later, I'd say it was around 1915, during the height of World War I, they opened an American front. They invaded Haiti, and the front lasted for 20 years.
All right, let's hold on right there, because we've got to take a break, and we'll come right back and continue. Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organic seed packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A one-pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed two people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The family pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of four. There's even a homestead pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed eight people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
Make sure you stay tuned, because you're listening to Feet to the Fire.
Gravity-fed water filters. That is the magic word for guaranteeing you pure fresh water regardless of what happens. You can find a river, stream, some source, any source of water. These filters will make them pure as the driven snow. Berkey's been a big name in filters for a long time, and we've had many sponsors to sell Berkey filters all over the years. And we have a new relationship with GetBerkey.com, and let me tell you why. Because not only do they have excellent supply of British Berkfield, as well as the American Berkey, but they also sell an array of filters that are the ceramic variety, you know, the ones that James McKinney has mentioned and recommended. So now you can go to GetBerkey.com and custom build the perfect system for you, a stainless steel, the plastic, the British Berkfield, the Berkey, the ceramic, the typical black filters. You know, there were some problems a while ago with the black filters. I had some that leaked as well. But that has all been fixed, and I'm confident they're okay. But since then, people have kind of went to the ceramic filters like Dalton. And so I really appreciate people at Get Berkey for putting together all these systems to let you choose. No one's forcing you to take any particular brand or variety. They'll educate you on the website about what is what and how to do to combine them. So what you need to do is go to our website and click through on our links to Get Berkey. That's Berkey, the British Berkfield, and the Dalton filters, all there, the ceramic as well as the black filters. GetBerkey.com, and tell them Beat the Fire sent you. So click through on our links to Get Berkey, and you will get Berkey. Also, for Feet the Fire listeners, people at Get Berkey has put together a coupon for 5% off your purchase. 5% off your purchase. Just put in F2F. That's a digit 2, F2F, as a coupon code to get an additional 5% off. And, of course, orders over $25 are free shipping. So there you go. Get Berkey and Feet to Fire. What a team.
Well, my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est? Pa 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 pa.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f at innersights.com. That's f2f at innersites.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Jancic.
Now, talking about the subject of zombies and whatnot, kind of interesting to pick out some bumper music that would fit. Hey, we're talking about Douglas Dietrich, zombies, and so far we've talked about the zombies from the zombie drug and its applications. And before we move on, Douglas, I had a question coming in from chat. These bath salts and whatnot, is there a possibility of this zombie drug being introduced to, say, marijuana or hash or anything like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a powder. It could be
You know, sometimes the powder, when you burn it, it changes chemically. I mean, would it survive smokifying so that you can then...
You know, that's an excellent point, but my understanding is that the bath salts are ingested already in any number of creative ways, that they are smoked, that they put into foods, that they are, you know, like coke, like...
Well, this could be the ultimate paraquat. You know, they by simply putting this stuff around here, it can cause a lot of trouble.
Well, that I think is always a potential. I think that the only way to prevent such a wave of zombie pharmacosis is to introduce this information to the public, educate them, make them aware of it, because their government sure as heck isn't doing the job. So I'm here to tell you what it is, what's it about, that this is part of a insurgency by a foreign power, and I want Americans to appreciate the gravity of the situation. And it's through James Arthur Jancic, Speak to the Fire, that you're going to hear the truth. So far, the first truth of this matter that has ever been exposed anywhere. And I say that I stake my reputation as a Department of Defense research librarian on exposing a security threat to the nation in this regard, And so hopefully the awareness can prevent it from getting any worse. I'm sure that no matter how cracked out or whacked out, there's very few people who want to become zombies.
And, no, seeing that, there was a report on television the other day, which I rarely watch, Lucinda does, and I'll walk in and out of the room, and they were having, I'm glad I did, they had a news report on these people doing bath salts in Florida, and they had pictures of these people, and it was absolutely horrifying. I mean, I've heard of people freaking out from angel dust, it was pretty bad, but I mean, this was absolutely horrible. Some of the pictures they've shown, videos of these people, these poor people, just mm-hmm. totally freaking out. Just totally.
Well, it reminds me of PCP in the sense that PCP is an elephant tranquilizer. It was originally a zoologist drug, not a veterinarian's drug, mind you. It was a zoologist drug, and it was meant for tranquilizing elephants. Which veterinarians do not normally contend with. Mostly zoologists will deal with elephants. So we're talking about an extremely powerful narcotic, and PCP was used recreationally during the 1990s when I worked the highest paid uniform security contract in the United States, which was the Acorn Projects in West Oakland, 762 units, 10 square city blocks. Totally different place now because we were working on it before it was a gated community. We actually had to vacate the population from one end of the project to the other as they ultimately surrounded it by gates so they could basically attempt to control who entered and who left and also lock all of the population inside in the event of riots. So during that process that I worked in that security contract, one of the PCP users that I had come across, I was dispatched normally. I used to walk the field in my first contract. My second contract, I was dispatch. And that was the most dangerous position because I was in the office where we had the prison. We had our own prison. Acorn had its own mortuary, just to put this into perspective for people. And we had our own prison, our own jail, our own holding area originally. And the walls were added later. That's what made it a jail and a detention cell. And so, gangs would break into the office to release prisoners. So the majority of people who died would die in offices and, who were guarding prisoners. So I had the most dangerous position as a dispatcher. Well, I was actually called into the field as a dispatcher at one point when they ran into a PCP user, and the reason why was because there were only 13 people on each shift, and I always, of course, worked graveyard, and all 12 of the other men were on top of this PCP user who were on shift that night, and so they called me over there, and they were saying, grab them, grab them. I'm like telling them, there's nothing to grab. There's 12 of you on top of them. It's like a football crunch. There's nothing to grab. And they said, just get on top of us. Grab something of him. And I crawled on top of them, and there was just this one gap amongst all of them where they're holding this individual down. I was able to reach through it with my arm, and I was able to grab what was a muscle of his. I think it was a shoulder muscle or a neck muscle. And it was bulging so tautly, it was like corded steel. And this individual began to rise with 13 people on top of him. Now, you can imagine someone like the brain of Einstein able to conceive of the mechanics of the universe. And yet, all of that goes out the window when you are witness to the physically impossible. There was no physical way for this man to rise. He had nothing on which to use as a lever against the 13 men on top of him. But PCP enabled him to do what he did. I witnessed another PCP user whose spine, whose spinal column, the discs of his spine were just audibly popping while he lifted a car. He was pushing the car up onto its side. One man by himself could hear the pops of the discs of his spine. He didn't feel anything. This is what PCP does. It's not giving you added strength. We would have men who would break handcuffs. I mean, think about what I'm saying. There's very few people on earth who can break handcuffs. And when this man broke the handcuffs, they had cut through his wrist to the bone. Now, PCP just kills all the pain. It's not that you're stronger. It's that you're not feeling any of the pain while your body is disintegrating under the impacts of the physically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That's what PCP does. Paul Dombey is very similar to that. That was what made Toussaint Louverture's troops undefeatable on the field of battle. And so we're talking about this is the kind of zombification where the walking dead, people who have flatlined for at least a period of time and are reanimated, are not feeling the pain that you and I feel. They have the strength of those who feel no pain. And so when the United States invaded Haiti in World War I in 1915 and spent the next 20 years there, there were experiments being conducted on Navassa Island. And those experiments continue to this day.
All right, now, I do want to jump in here to remind you that we do have two other spaces to go here. So you might want to, because it's about 1:45, we got like an hour and 15 minutes minus the breaks and so on.
So I'll be happy to go there. By that, you mean the cannibalism and the prions?
Yeah, the prions. And I want to definitely get in here, the neutron bomb creating these, and that there were troops stationed in the radiation belt purposely. And who is the only nation on the Earth that has neutron bombs now, and why, and all that. So put that all along in your little path when we get to it.
I think that's excellent. We'll do that. Just to finish up with Navassa Island, it is still maintained today by the United States, even though it's been totally mined of phosphates. It is still occupied, even though it's constitutionally part of the nation of Haiti and was rendered part of their constitution back in 1801. So it's still an occupied part of Haiti by the United States. Now, basically, the United States claims that it is part of the United States, though most Americans obviously have never heard of it. And this is something enforced by the United States Coast Guard per the provisions of Title 43 U.S. Code, Section 1458, by which the United States Department of the Interior has assumed responsibility for civil administration. And basically, the director of the American Office of Insular Affairs, acting under authority delegated unto him through the Secretary's Order number 3205 of January 16, 1997, and Amendment number 1, January 14th of 1998, regards this as basically someplace which no one can enter. So basically, it's indefinitely forbidden to allow visitations to the Navassa Island and its surrounding surrounding waters. And this is deemed the surrounding waters. As a matter of fact, I know for a fact that the line on the water is 12 nautical miles distant from the Navassa Island coastlines. So if provoked enough, the U.S. Coast Guard will kill to enforce that. So no one is allowed on the island today. And it is equivalent to what Vozhonets Denye is in the Soviet Union, which is basically a dumping ground for toxic weapons. And the toxic weapons that are left in both areas include essentially zombies, what we would term as such. And anyone who laughs at this or thinks this is ridiculous, again, they're just not, they're not listening to anything that I've said thus far. And to put this into perspective for you about the prions and the neutron bomb, because that's where we're going, the natural zombie as generated through Vuhuduns is meant to be a controlled individual, an asset of labor or war, but not some wild, cannibalistic entity that attacks anything like a shark smelling blood. But what causes that? Aside from improper mixture of chemicals, as has happened with bath salts, is the phenomenon of the prion. Now, the prion is known as, it's an acronym, and it stands for protonaceous infectious ion, and it is simply a misfolded protein. All of our bodies consist of countless proteins. When these proteins get misfolded, then we develop this phenomena of prionization. And this is what manifests more benignly, if you can use that term, in mad cow disease and Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, also Alzheimer's. And it was first hypothesized by Dr. Stanley Ben Preisner back in the 1970s. He ultimately won the Nobel Prize in Medicine when it was irrefutably proven to be a fact. And I think that wasn't until the 1990s. And the end result of Stanley Ben Preisner winning this Nobel Prize in 1997 was that science was forced to confront something which, even though he had talked about it back in the 1970s, they were unwilling to acknowledge it because of the horrific ramifications. Because what science cannot understand or explain, for all functional purposes, is magic. And prions are essentially in that range of misunderstanding. We don't comprehend prions. We don't know how to kill prions. The only way to get rid of prions is to disassemble them at the molecular level, a nuclear furnace. But other than that, bleach doesn't kill them. Flame doesn't kill them. You could have fires that are close to the range of the heat of the sun, and it doesn't kill them. And they don't die. They last forever. They're not biological in the normal sense of the word. They are misfolded proteins of life, but not of life. They are the stuff of life, but not alive. And they don't reproduce by DNA. To give you an example of this, there are familial cases, by that I mean through family bloodlines, and they account for about 10% of TSEs, which are transmissible, spongiform, encephalopathies. Now, to give you an example of how dangerous this is, I was a student of medical journalism for about a decade while I was taking care of my parents in their terminal decade. So from the year 2000 to the year 2010, essentially, I was taking care of both of my parents. And when I was taking care of them to advocate for them more effectively as senior patients, I took medical journalism courses at UCSF. So I have the credit equivalent of a master's degree in medical journalism. Now, they brought in lecturers from all over the world, and mostly UCSF alma mater, of which there were many that were exemplary and world-renowned, such as Dr. Preisner. Now, I attended his lecture, and he pointed at the audience of 300 people in the UCSF auditorium, swept his arm and said, one out of every three of you in this room will come down with Alzheimer's. And that's a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. And that's the sexually transmitted disease of the future, the STD of the future, TSEs. And not that it goes through sex. It goes through anything. Usually transmitted by bite. And our saliva, exchange of fluids, eating the flesh of something that's infected with prionization. So what exactly is it? Well, these TSEs create the spongy-like holes, the Swiss cheese of the brain, which leads to the dementia and Alzheimer's that we're so familiar with. Please don't interpret a relative suffering from Alzheimer's as being a cannibal or anyone who's a danger other than in the obvious dangers to themselves and others through their senility. Don't interpret them as a zombie. But the reason that prions originally resulted was traced back to the phenomena of cannibalism. And in terms of cannibalism, it was originally studied by Dr. Paweł Leberski of the Polish universities, and he basically went to New Guinea to study the tribe that was suffering from kuru, a disease which means trembling with fear in the New Guinea language, the Papuan language. And Dr. Paweł Leberski represented the Department of Molecular Pathology at the Medical University of Lodz in Poland. And when he was studying the Fore tribes people in New Guinea, Alzheimer's had reached epidemic proportions. And it turned out it was because they were cannibalizing other tribes people that they had defeated and cannibalizing their dead out of respect. And when the practice of cannibalism was stopped, then the kurusomnia, meaning the walking dead phenomena, stopped. And the end result was, this is what led to Dr. Stanley Ben Preisner's research to find out, well, what caused the kurusomnia. That's what led to the isolation of the prion. Now, to give you an example of how prions work, in a way we don't understand. As I said, there are familial cases for about 10% of transmissible spongiform encephalopathies that are passed down through bloodlines in ways that we don't understand because they're not inherited. They stick with family lines, but not through DNA. And there's this version called fatal familial insomnia, FFI, an ultra-rare disease found in only a couple of dozen bloodlines in the world, in which the victim cannot ever fall asleep, not even when medicated, not even when drunk. The victim becomes delusional, erratic, lingers in a living hell of unending wakefulness until months later, exhaustion and brain damage causes death. Now, because it jumps, it's not inherited, it jumps generations. So these are how the families continue to propagate. Basically, two or three generations down the road, someone will manifest it, but not by inheriting it. It's the equivalent of a family curse. This is, because we don't know how to explain it scientifically, we can only say it's supernatural. It's the functional equivalent of magic. And you can take someone with prions, and they don't test for it often, because the testing eliminates not only your ability to use the scalpel or the testing materials again, the bone saws, everything else, because they're all infected with prions, and you can't bleach them, you can't heat them, there's no way you can clean them. You dismantle all of them, plus you dismantle all of your suit, your hazmat suit that you're wearing. The lab itself has to be destroyed. So there's literally several levels of biohazard. There's four, to be exact. And these four levels are basically for different levels of disease based on how fast it spreads, how deadly it is. The hemorrhagic fevers have a 100% mortality rate. Now, they do and they don't, and here's the reason why. The hemorrhagic fevers don't spread fast enough. They affect the sufferer so fast they can't spread. That's why when you get Ebola or these various outbreaks in Africa, they don't wind up wiping out entire areas of the continent.
It's like when they dig a fire break, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, they run out of trees to burn. In this case, they run out of alive humans to carry it to the next batch of live humans.
That's right. Basically, these people suffering from Ebola basically wind up dropping so fast, they're not around long enough to spread the disease. Marburg, Crimean Congo viruses, these are biosafety level 4 because when you are around, you can catch it so easily because the person, it has so many open sores. In a very real sense, you can say they're melting in front of you. And because their open sores are leaking all of this pus, just being near them, breathing in particulate matter from their disintegrating body can trigger the phenomena in yourself. The disease will manifest in you. You will suffer it, and you will drop. But it spreads so fast, it can't create a pandemic such as avian flu, which basically has a 10% mortality rate. That's why he killed 100 million people in World War I and edged out the Black Plague worldwide, because it could spread so much easier because only 10% of the people are dying, which is horrific enough. Now, to put this into perspective for the listening audience, by measure of comparison, AIDS is a threat level 2. It's a biohazard level 2 agent. Basically, it will die on any external surface. It requires a very tight 98.6 degree temperature to survive. So you can have someone with AIDS bleeding, sitting on a toilet seat, and you could have an open cut on your rear end, sit on that same toilet seat after they left. The chances are extremely high you're not going to catch it because the virus would have died by the time you sit down, just based on the cold of the toilet seat. Now with prions, there is no level for them. It goes beyond threat level 4. We have to create a new level of biohazard safety level 5 for prions. That's what we're talking about with them. And so, well, what happens with the prions in terms of burying them? You can have someone like a cow or a human being infected with prions, and after you do the autopsy and you have to disintegrate the entire lab, the hazmat suits of everyone involved, all of the surgical instruments, everything, then you bury that body. You have to bury it like it's nuclear waste and hope no one ever digs it up again. Because like nuclear waste at least has a half-life, as far as we know, prions do not. You could bury a body with prions, 200 years later you'll dig it up and those prions are still infectious.
So in other words, when they had the mad cow problems and they burned those cows, that really, the burying of them is the only thing that's keeping them from spreading.
That is correct.
And it may not even be doing a good job at that. But hold on, we're going to hit the music. We're going to take the break. And we'll come back and continue with hour three with the Douglas Dietrich on zombies.
Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organics seed packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A one-pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed two people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The family pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of four. There's even a homestead pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed eight people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
Are you getting your greens? I'm James Othianchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Inner Food by Inner Health Botanicals. Inner Food is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Inner Food is spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, spinach, alfalfa, barley, wheatgrass, rosehip, beetroot, and much more in real amounts, not just a sprinkle to fill out an inflated but impotent list of ingredients. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Inner Food is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, feedtofire.com, and click on any Inner Health Botanical banner and you're ready to order. Or call 866-762-9238 and be sure to mention you heard them on Feet to the Fire. Enter Food, building health from the insides out.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Janczyk.
That's nothing I would request, actually. I thought it was kind of fun looking for bumpers. Anyway, we're here talking with Douglas Dietrich. Now, the subject is far from funny. It is quite grave. And it does show that there are some, yet another thing to worry about. Could be the worst yet to come. But it's good to know, and one can deal with and take action. So Douglas Dietrich is here. You know, Douglas, why don't you give us your...
website information and let them know about your coming. You're going to be appearing and lecturing somewhere. So let's get all that out there before we forget.
Yeah, I really appreciate your bringing that up. Thank you so much. And I would like the audience to know, please reference www.douglasdietrich.com. Douglas is spelled with one S. Dietrich is spelled just like the famous actress Marlena Dietrich, a distant relative of mine. And all you need to do, if you're younger and you don't remember Marlena Dietrich, just put the words diet and rich together. D-I-E-T for diet, R-I-C-H for rich, diet rich. So just look up DouglasDietRich.com. And we are discontinuing our DVD package as soon as all of these currently remaining DVD sets are gone. They will never be reissued again, as the one DVD, Roswell and the Rising Sun, which led directly to my mother's death, will analog into printed text format, will probably be undergoing cinematic exposure at some other point to counter military industrial propaganda films like Independence Day, The Battle of L.A., while I anticipate relating materials pertinent to the content of the other DVD, Satan's Crusaders, on delivering the opening presentation of the first ever event of its kind, the Super Soldier Summit No. 1, convening at San Rafael in California's Marin County on Saturday, June the 23rd of this month. And please reference www.supersoldiersummit.com for related details concerning that. The title of my lecture will be basically either American demonolatry or military demonolatry, basically the military aspects of Satanism and their effect on the U.S. criminal state as an empire. And so I will be speaking of what I speak of in the DVD, but the DVD is very pertinent. Mr. Yanchik and I have gone over aspects of Satanism in the military before and how it's so influenced and subverted our armed forces. Again, please reference www.supersoldiersummit.com for details concerning that. But anyhow, towards this end, we are offering two DVDs for the price of one until depletion of supply. And certainly you can go to my website, douglasdietrich.com, big blue Facebook button. Just press that button. I'll take you to my public timeline. And on there you will find the accusations, the slander and defamation from John Lear. And obviously see how this has taken a new turn and a new development in terms of my life, a life in which I've experienced clinical death myself more than once. So when I say I don't really care whether I live or die, I really mean that. I've been dead before, and the very fact that I've survived without suffering the brain damage of Rom Halbin or Terry Schiavo, I am infinitely grateful for. I don't treat my life cheaply. And that's why I also emphasize the fact that I will sell it dearly if they're trying to follow up, and if John Lear represents some kind of governmental rattling like a snake before it strikes. As I said before, I have the collateral information that will make many of their members regret the day they were born. That'll be released upon any news of my death. But moving right along to more.
But actually, let me throw in, now this book, The Reality of the Red Undead, is that something that should be, it's June 2012. Is that something we can look forward to soon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're speaking of some of its contents tonight.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, what I'm speaking of now, aspects of this will probably, be in other books. And then there's, the aspects that will be in that book, because what I am limited to by the context of the title is, of course, The Reality of the Red Undead, the true story of the supernatural Soviets. As a matter of fact, I'm so deep into working on it that I forgot to even push it, because it will be released extremely soon. And my biggest problem, my greatest challenge, as you can probably ascertain by some of what I'm speaking about tonight, is that it's so technical in terms of the medical details. What I wanted to write, and did write, was a book that no chemist, no medical doctor could deny. The problem is, no average person could read it.
Yeah,
there's
a way to say it, and then you got to say it so people who don't, you know, have the lingo. Actually, let me interrupt you for a second, and we do have a call coming in, and I had a couple calls that just hang up, so I don't know if there's somebody to hear at this time. Hello, you're on the air live with Douglas Dietrich.
Oh, hello, Douglas. It's Adam in Vancouver. I've talked to you on Facebook.
Fantastic.
Hello.
Yeah, we hear you.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, the reason I was calling, you divulge a great load of information. I find it absolutely fantastic. Your history is second to none out there, and you know, you have a lot to spread, a lot of information to get out there. Now, my question for you is, you talk a lot about the satanic correlation with the military. Now, I know the that comes from the British side, isn't it? Is that correct?
Yes, originally it was indeed, sir, something that started with the British Empire.
Yeah. Now, I guess you know the right hand and the left hand of guardians of the City of London, right? Did you know about that information?
Oh, is this, you, by the way, I think I remember your last name. Am I permitted to say your last name on air?
You know who I am. You know who I am, right?
Yes, it took me a few seconds. Yes, but I've never spoken to you before, so it's great to hear your voice, and I very much appreciate speaking to you.
I deleted myself off of Facebook, but no, I just wanted to kind of touch base with you here.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sad you deleted yourself from Facebook, but yeah, not that I'm avoiding the question.
No, I feel uplifted that I have.
Okay, but in terms of the right and left areas of London, that might be a bit too symbolic for me in terms of being able to address it. A lot of the more esoteric symbolism can essentially, how would I say it, it's just not in my area. Because you're dealing with, at that point, not that I'm not unfamiliar with the occult, but you're speaking about very culture-specific geomancy. In other words, what the Chinese would call feng shui. And it's very culture-specific, and I don't know what was in the mind of the builders of London. And London has been continuously expanded. Obviously, it existed as Londinium in the time of the Romans, and has expanded ever since. So there's all kinds of history to it.
And it fought the French and the Spanish for centuries and held
yes,
its ground.
Yes, yes.
And, you
yes,
know, and had a little conflict with the Germans, but
yeah.
London has still held its ground, right?
Right, and I appreciate your call and question. Do you have something more specific to the topic on hand, though?
Yeah, okay, no, I just wanted to call touch base to say to Douglas, appreciation for your knowledge. The other question was, now, so with the bath salts coming out, this being a new drug coming out on the market, what would the subculture be targeted as? Because it's got into the country somehow, or America somehow, like, you know, all the other drugs, they'll start targeting subgroups to get it out. Like, how is that going to all unfold?
We can only...
Okay, all right, well, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, honor to hear from you. And thank you, Adam. Sorry he's off Facebook. But at any rate, in terms of targeting subcultures, it doesn't look like there's a target specific subculture at this point, even though it's been around a long time. And we're just beginning to see which cultures are abusing this particular drug. Now, based on just the most notorious example of the two men that stripped down due to the incredible heat, an entire inflammation occurs throughout the nervous system that is felt by people who have suffered from Pao Zombie, or the zombie toxin, and they wind up feeling as if their skin is on fire. Totally unable to move or maneuver at all, as if armies of insects were swarming underneath their epidermis. And this is what survivors have reported when they are rehabilitated to whatever extent they can be rehabilitated during the initial phase of the zombie toxin kicking them into the flatline zone. And that's when they hear doctors, American trained or otherwise, pronouncing them dead. And so at that point, the inflammation might settle down, but these men obviously felt it, removed all of their clothes. They were both naked on the ground. They both looked Caucasian, though we're unsure. They could have been Latin American. But certainly, I think that we can only wait and see. I think that this is not a culture-specific targeting. This is a military weapon being utilized on a front of insurgency. This is an insurgency. and this is a weapon of the insurgency. So keep that in mind and defend yourself
You describe the effects of it. It's something that is this the same thing these soldiers took? I bet you if they took it once, they probably wouldn't want to take it again.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, because what it takes to go through the flatline phase, they probably wish they were dead.
Well, keep in mind that under Toussaint Louverture, these men were fighting for their freedom. They were living in lives as slaves. And if you have a choice between your children's children growing up as slaves and suffering the agonies of hell to ensure the fact that they will not, most men would walk through fire, any men who were worthy of the name. And these men, of course, were volunteering to be zombified only in the event of being mortally wounded. Keep in mind, it wouldn't kick in unless they were mortally wounded, because they were administered a very small dose. Toussaint Louverture was a doctor of his age. As a matter of fact, a later ruler of Haiti, the dictator Papa Doc Duvalier, he basically was an MD, and he was world famous for fighting diseases. And he became a black nationalist, and he ran Haiti for a good period of time. Certainly, he lived out his life. His son inherited the dynasty, and it was only after his son took over that the dynasty was overthrown by a combination of everything from Canadian mercenaries from the Commonwealth, American spies, and Cuban insurgents. The Soviets, the Americans, and the British hated him because he represented black empowerment, which was a threat to their interests in the Caribbean, especially in places where the British dominated, such as Jamaica. So remember that as a black independent republic, Haiti is loathed and hated by the superpowers of the world. And
it makes you wonder if that earthquake, you know, might not have been all that accidental.
Believe me, the president in 1915 who wanted to retake Navassa Island for Haiti during the World War One period, he was going to ally with the Germans, retake Navassa Island. His name was William Sam. And Jean Valdrun William San was known as the half-year president. He was a former Haitian minister of war. And in 1915, as he was preparing to invade Navassa Island, suddenly, like something out of a zombie film, a spontaneous crowd erupted out of nowhere, came into the presidential palace of Haiti, dragged him outside, and tore him apart limb from limb by the bare hands.
That sounds like a zombie army to me.
And that was almost certainly American instigated, because the Americans invaded directly afterwards to restore order, supposedly, stayed there for the next 20 years. So this is the kind of brutality that we're dealing with on an international level. Now getting back to the medical level, when I was speaking of the prions, I think we've covered a good deal of what the prions are. How does the neutron bomb fit in? Well, basically, there was an individual named Dr. Samuel Cohen. He was of Jewish descent, and he was extremely well aware of what had happened in the time of the Third Reich when Adolf Hitler had basically overrun all of Europe and created an empire that was geographically larger than the United States in terms of land area. And the way he did that, through the Blitzkrieg of his panzer units, well, at the height of the Third Reich, 25% of the Nazi tank fleet came from other countries. Talking about over 16,000 stolen British, Czech, French, Italian, Polish, and Soviet tanks under German colors, utilized by Adolf Hitler. Dr. Samuel Cohen said, as a physicist, what kind of bomb can I design where America can cannibalize other people's tanks, specifically the Soviets, if their armored columns were to invade Western Europe? So he developed the neutron bomb. The neutron bomb is an ERW, an enhanced radiation weapon, a tactical fission-fusion thermonuclear weapon designed specifically to release a large portion of its energy as energetic neutron radiation rather than explosive energy. The bursts of neutrons generated by its fusion reaction are intentionally allowed to escape. And so they're basically what you have is an ER weapons explosion, and so it releases radiation more than it does a blast. And the reason why was so that if Soviet or any other country's armored columns were advancing, the neutron bomb would kill everybody inside of these vehicles and leave the vehicles unharmed and intact for American cannibalization. And so when he developed this weapon in the 1950s, he presented it ultimately to President Kennedy in 1961, and Kennedy found the weapon so abhorrent, he only allowed an underground test in Nevada. And that defeated the purpose of the weapon entirely, because it's meant to be blasted in the atmosphere for the effects of its radiation to have impact. Now, by the time of the mid-1980s, we had open-air testing. Now, why is this so unusual? Because all open-air testing of nuclear bombs and weapons was outlawed by the mid-1960s, by all powers in the world. All the Security Council member states of the United Nations, France, Communist China by that point, the Soviet Union, United Kingdom, United States, all had agreed to no above-ground nuclear testing. So how did they get away with it? Because it wasn't classified as a nuclear bomb. It was classified as an energy weapon. Now, in all of the classic nuclear tests, the Americans have always wiped out American troops as par for the course. They would have American soldiers park 2,000 yards from the stem of a mushroom cloud. And these mushroom clouds, these nuclear explosions, were kilotonnage, megatonnage, Yucca Flats, Nevada. They blew off over 500,000 of them. And they're so powerful, they would fog film in Rochester, New York, or Kodak Company Town. They would fog Kodak film all the way at the other end of the continent. That's how much radiation got blown by the jet stream, which apparently John Lear doesn't understand when he says the Japanese couldn't use it to power the dirigibles across the Pacific. I mean, if I get back into that, perhaps we'll have a few minutes at the end of the show, or certainly we'll have another one. But my point is, with the Americans, they also had sailors at Inuvituq, Kwajalein Island, Bikini Atoll, right at the heart of nuclear explosions, ordered to sail right through the stems of mushroom clouds. Over the years of these tests, 300,000 military personnel died of radiation. We're talking about, like, some of these people were literally 2 miles from ground zero, 2,000 yards from ground zero, however far away, depending on how soon you died. I remember destroying the journal that was confiscated from a Sergeant Riesenwerheim, last name spelled W-A-R-E-H-I-M-E. I turned that over to someone who uploaded it on the Internet. I hope people can find his journal. At any rate, he was 2 miles from ground zero on one of these tests, and they were wearing goggles. He threw his hands up over his eyes, closed his eyes. He could still see the bones of his hands because of the X-ray effects of these nuclear weapons. Then they were ordered to march into ground zero. They would come up on troops that were closer to the atom blast. All the sandbags everywhere were on fire. These troops are all vomiting. His own teeth fell out. His hair fell out. He was tested as sterile. And this was, you know, I'm talking about right then and there, his teeth fell out, his hair fell out. He got tested as sterile about 2 weeks later. They would get rounded up by the boys in moon suits for research. Ultimately, of course, he died. So what does this mean? 300,000 military personnel, a third of a million people? That's basically the combination of Hiroshima and Nagasaki put together. That's how many Americans died in conventional nuclear testing. Well, in the mid-1980s, under Ronald Reagan, who loved the neutron bomb, the Air Force conducted a neutron bomb test in open air, had all the troops standing, blast zone radius, and this time the boys in moon suits had a surprise waiting for them. They were confronted with frenzied, cannibalistic DAFs. That was the acronym. Decedent Ambulatory Prionic Hosts. It turned out there's a side effect. The neutron bomb, you've never heard of it again for a reason. It basically generates what's known as an ERMI, Enhanced Radioactivated Molecular Ionization Event. And the end result is it instantly creates zombies. Cannibalistic, wild, feral, uncontrollable zombies. Vacuolization of the brain, entire degeneration into a cannibalistic humanoid, the likes of which the world has never seen. Worse yet, the same wind that would fog up the film in upstate New York carried what were known as PIMPs, prionic, isoformulaic, microscopic particles, all the way across the United States, dropped on down various towns in the Appalachians, various towns in the Adirondacks, little small town areas, and the U.S. government was confronted with DAFs, desiccant ambulatory prionic hosts, taking over entire towns. Now, you want to ask, how is it, why is it, at Ruby Ridge, at Waco, you got police units coming in, and they just automatically kill without thought? This is where it comes from. Government knew it couldn't send in the National Guard. They sent in the National Guard, these boys are going to talk. So they grabbed FBI, ATF, SOGRs, special operations groups from these police units, the alphabet agencies, sent them in with the orders to kill everybody because they were already dead. You couldn't call it murder. And they wound up just trained, militarized as extermination units to the point where by the time they're dealing with human beings, they can't stop themselves. Ruby Ridge, Waco, they just kill everybody.
So this group was created to go in and find these zombies that were affected by this neutron radiation.
There may ultimately have been a specific unit. I don't believe so. I believe it's simply units operations.
What I meant, that was the purpose. The purpose was they found out this radiation is creating zombies. It's blowing around the country. They find out where the winds blow, and then they go in and check to see if anything happened.
Well, they know when something happens. Basically, all communication stops from a particular geographic area. You know something's up. I mean, there's one thing the government can't stand is when people aren't paying taxes. If you've got nobody paying their taxes or the phone bills for about a few weeks, a few months, you know something's up. They would send these units in, and they'd see what was up. What was up was people who should have been lying down, people who should have been dead. They went in there, and they finished them off. And that's how they've reacted ever since. Problem is, how can you untrain somebody from reacting like that when they're confronted with this kind of challenge? Not that I'm defending them.
Right. No, but I understand. I'm just saying that, you know, so we have maybe stories of people in the mountain being weird and all this, maybe traced to some of these events.
Keep in mind, cancer never existed till 1945. After 1945, the world is loaded with cancers. We've exploded over 2,000 open-air nuclear bombs since that point in time. And cancer has just astronomically increased, and everybody just accepts it. Nobody questions it. Has anybody ever said, hey, why is there no medical record of this? No one in the history of mankind has ever come down with cancer. Suddenly, we accept it. This is another byproduct, a hazard of living in the age of radiation that they've unleashed upon us in total incompetence and irresponsibility. The French conducted some neutron bomb tests at Rurutu Atoll in the Pacific, suffered the same, dismantled all the nuclear weapons. All the neutron weapons. The Americans gave the orders for dismantling all of their neutron shells. Basically, they had four major types. There was a W-79. Last one was dismantled in 2003. W-70 Mod 3 warhead was dismantled in 1996. These orders were given by George Bush Sr., so you know it had to be serious. There was a W-79 Mon Zero, and that was developed for artillery shells for use in the field, if you can believe that. They had to hunt down all those and dismantle them. Worst one yet was one you'll probably never even find on the Internet, the W-69. That was a strategic neutron bomb. You would kill off an entire city, theoretically, and be able to occupy it. Only instead, they found out you'd get an entire city full of zombies.
Yeah, oops.
Now, in terms of the end result was, who would be insane enough, and for what reason, to maintain an arsenal of neutron weapons? There's only one nation in today, in this day and age, and that's per Dr. Samuel Cohen himself, the doctor who invented the neutron bomb. There's only one nation today that maintains an arsenal of about 300 neutron bombs.
Now, before we go there, think about this statement. The United States had this, and France, And they said, of all the abominational stuff they have, MKUltra to these various LSDs infesting in the 60s, I mean, we can go on and on and on, right? And so they decided, well, wait a minute, this is just too bad to use. And so they dismantled all of them. I mean, even that alone is amazing that they wouldn't just keep some just in case or for whatever reason.
I agree.
So that kind of leads up that who else would bother to keep this with all these ramifications? And, well, actually, let's just wait there for a second. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk about the nation that has it, why they have it, and so on. We got another 30 minutes. We could probably talk for another 4 hours, but we can't until the next time. But hold on. We'll be back with another half hour with Douglas Dietrich. We had a tweet from a listener, Debbie, who has commented that the show is interesting and Douglas Dietrich is great. So thanks to her. And we'll be back live after this.
Make sure you stay tuned, because you're listening to Feet to the Fire.
I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio and creator and host of Feet to the Fire. Have you ever noticed the high volume of commercials on most talk shows? It is to the point that it seems like topics are the bait and the guests are the fillers to sell products. I've made a conscious decision to keep disruptions to a minimum and provide more uninterrupted time for the real reason you tuned in. You hear guests with more time to make their points, allowing me and listeners to intuitively, intelligently formulate questions by having less interruptions to break the stream of consciousness. Feet to the Fire may be free to listen to, but it's not free to provide. We rely heavily on donations to offset the expenses of producing the show. If you like what we are doing and enjoy the show, why not consider donating via PayPal or a major credit card from our website, feettofire.com?
Or write us at Feet to the Fire, P.O. Box 511, Minooka, Illinois, 60447. Thank you.
James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at F2F at Innersights.com. That's F2F at Innersites.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action, as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Janczyk.
Well, I was putting together all these bumpers having to do with zombies, and I guess I missed the last bumper, and perhaps that was something meant to be, kind of more of a positive prayer that we could to begin the day, and maybe the day might begin soon with this information that's coming out, and people can act on it from people like Douglas Diedrich, who come out with the and let us know, and thus we let other people know, and it goes on, and then only through knowledge can you even hope to have a change. And we're back with Douglas Diedrich, and welcome.
Yes, thank you. And we were speaking about that arsenal of that nation in question. Well, Dr. Samuel Cohen, of course, was of Jewish descent. Now, whether he personally helped to establish this arsenal or not is open to debate, but it was he himself who insisted that the State of Israel maintains an arsenal of 300 neutron bombs. And on the basis of the horrific collateral damage that is ancillary to the deployment of these weapons, one might ask, why on earth would any nation whose leadership retained a modicum of sanity maintain a neutron arsenal? Well, the reason is because its radiation that's released is indeed so potent that it scrambles the electronic brains of any incoming ICBMs. The State of Israel, of course, the size that it is, as people have often said, is a one-bomb nation. Reality, that's kind of exaggerating it. A couple of nuclear weapons would effectively wipe it out as a functional entity geographically. Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, the Jerusalem, of course, and other areas, and the State of Israel, as we know it, is gone, and the people that live there have essentially been exterminated. So the only Jewish culture that would survive at that point would be the diaspora. So to prevent incoming nuclear weapons from doing just that to the State of Israel and the Jewish culture, they maintain the neutron bombs to launch as anti-ballistic missiles, a radiation shield, if you will, scrambling the brains by mid-air bursts of all incoming ICBMs. And the creation of a collateral zombie apocalypse would be infinitely easier for Israel to deal with its firepower as opposed to absorbing the incoming nuclear blast. So that there is a logic to that. Not that I'm saying it's justifiable, but that would be their logic.
Yeah, and you know, and I never even thought about the closeness. But in order to get hit by a nuclear weapon, wouldn't somebody have to be able to throw it at you? And do you have any knowledge that any area, anybody within striking distance, say except for like the Russians, actually have nuclear strike capability against Israel?
I would assume that certainly Iran, the House of Saud, a number of other nations have nuclear strike capability against Israel. The nuclear weapons are everywhere. They've proliferated just exponentially. If you assume that someone doesn't have nuclear weapons, you'd be naive. Here's the catch. Most nuclear weapons need to be delivered almost by hand. So in terms of delivering nuclear weapons to Israel, it would be basically by men carrying it in, either on a truck or literally by hand. At one point, Israel did catch someone coming through the checkpoints who had a very small, potent, low-yield tactical nuclear weapon that was essentially being carried on his person, literally on a backpack that was literally so heavy the straps were cutting into his shoulders, and the reason they noticed him is because his shoulders were bleeding around his neck. So this was a suicide bomber, the ultimate suicide bomber. Now, the reason it has to be like that is because the fusion-fission cores of nuclear weapons are leaking radioactivity constantly. And these are, after all, nuclear weapons. And it rots and corrodes and corrupts the electronics that compromise the guidance system. This is why the United States made trillions of dollars, not billions, trillions of dollars off of you, your back and mine as taxpayers, maintaining a nuclear arsenal. Because every single physicist knows this, but they would never tell you that if they were ever to launch a full-scale nuclear strike, because people kept asking, how many bombs do they need? The Soviets have thousands of nuclear bombs. The Americans have thousands of nuclear missiles. Why do they need so many? Well, here's why. Because the moment they launched a full-scale nuclear strike, both sides knew over 75%, closer to 95%, would blow up in their silos. And the rest wouldn't work at all. They just wouldn't even launch. The reason they knew this was because they rot their wiring. They rot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they have to be highly maintained.
Yes, that's where the money comes in. That's what collapsed the Soviet Union, one of the many factors. That was a big factor. The Soviet Union didn't have a military-industrial complex. It was a military-industrial complex. That was its economy. Its entire economy was its strategic rocket forces. And that's what killed it, along with so many other factors. That's one of the major factors that killed it. They couldn't maintain that. It had nothing to do with Star Wars or SDI, Ronald Reagan bankrupting it. That's absurd. There were many factors, but that was certainly a big one. The Americans, same thing. And the Americans just ran our economy into the ground, maintaining this. And every physicist knew it. All these popular physicists, Dr. Charles Schultz, who says that there are fossils on Mars, knew this. He worked in weapons. Michio Kaku knew this. He worked in weapons. Stanton Friedman knows this. He worked in weapons. Now, all of these physicists who get these public accolades, they want the kidney-shaped swimming pools. They want the blonde trophy wives. So they went along with a scam. They truly are corrupt. They truly are evil. They truly deserve no sympathy or any kind of affinity. They have basically corrupted your nation. They've changed the entire business of science and the entire science of business to basically maintain this nuclear arsenal that would never work. And they knew it. And they didn't care because they were living fat and still are living fat. And if it takes lying to you and saying, yeah, there's aliens, and they were here, and we got secret technology just to promote their lifestyle. Believe me, they have no qualms about doing it. They had no qualms about bankrupting the future of your children's children over this. Now, all of these nuclear weapons that were never meant to work, just meant to rot so they could repair them again and again and again. Anybody who works on an Air Force base, it's near a missile silo, will tell you this. Because the Air Force maintained it. The Air Force is the most corrupt of all the service branches. They are truly treasonous. To give you an example of this, in 1961, the Strategic Air Command came up to President Kennedy, and they said, Mr. President, the Soviets have thousands of ICBMs ready to launch, about 2,000 of them. And they said, here, and they showed them all of these photographs from U-2's reconnaissance satellites, and we had reconnaissance satellites in 1961. And they showed them all of these photos, and they pointed to every single grain silo, every single war memorial, every single church spire, and they said, that's an ICBM, that's an ICBM, that's an ICBM ready to launch. Well, now, undeniably, no one can refute this. 1961, the very year they were telling Kennedy that, they knew for a fact that the Soviet Union had four, count them, four operational ICBMs. And they were so confident, because they knew this, that the launch code for their ICBMs was... Guess what? What would you say their launch code was? Because they knew they were never going to suffer a nuclear attack. It was all zeros. It was eight zeros for all of their launch codes so that no one would ever have to think that all of the flyboys who never flew bombers anymore, all the Strategic Air Command that was supposed to bomb the heck out of any enemy nation, wound up crawling underground, sitting in the world's most comfortable chairs, watching bombs that they knew would never work. And because they didn't want to think, or, you know, basically they weren't worried about a Soviet attack, they knew that they could attack first and launch anytime they wanted, because the attack would be meaningless anyway. So all of the launch codes from 1961, the time that they approached Kennedy, all the way up through 1977, were eight zeros. And Robert McNamara, the defense secretary, didn't know this until 2004. And when he was told this in 2004, he was shocked. He had no idea. Now, this is something the Strategic Air Command and your Air Force kept to itself. This is treason. These people are traitors. When they came up and they lied to the president, these people wanted fat life. They wanted the good things that they could get only by ripping you and your future off. They've destroyed the future of your children to carry this off. So have no sympathies for them. They are not patriots. They are not on your side. Most of all, they're not doing what they're paid to do. They're not defending you. And the end result about all of these bombs and everything else about them is, okay, let's look at something practical. How come China was a superpower? Initially, China became a superpower by sheer manpower. Sheer manpower brought China into the nuclear age without nuclear bombs because they could absorb multiple nuclear attacks and keep on coming. Then they developed nuclear weapons. And suddenly they're a superpower with 200 nuclear weapons. Between 150 to 300 nuclear weapons is all that China's ever had. That's all it's got today. And you have to ask yourself, how do they get away with it? Because they use the cutting edge of German World War II era Peenemünde Rakatan technology, same as the Reich had, and they have clockwork mechanisms for the nuclear warheads. And they just send in the men with moon suits every few months to rewind them.
Hmm.
And they don't rot. So they're fixed aim. This is pointed at Chicago. All it can hit is Chicago. But it's going to hit Chicago. They got one that'll hit Canberra, one that'll hit Tokyo. They'll have all these bombs, just a few hundred of them, pointed at a few hundred targets on the Earth, and it'll make it there on a clockwork mechanism. And all the electronic BS garbage about, oh, we can make it do spirals in flight. We can recall it halfway to its target. All this stuff was a lie anyway, and none of it could be done. In China's case, they have a nuclear arsenal that can work. And guess what? Notice the difference in economy. Whereas the Soviet Union has collapsed and the United States is in collapse, China's economy is roaring because it hasn't surrendered to its military-industrial complex and this nuclear scam. So I hope that puts that in perspective. Now, we've covered the prionism, and this is a result, ultimately, of cannibalization. It produces cannibalization, and ironically, it was produced by a radiation bomb that was meant to provide the ability to cannibalize machines, or even real estate. The ultimate capitalist weapon, if you will.
Well, you know, I don't really realize... I do realize when we talk like this, how serious Eisenhower was with his statement. I mean, you hear it, and anecdotally, you talk about, there's a war race and all that, but it really was a scam war race, and it broke our backs. And who goes away with all the money?
Well, the U.S. Air Force, the physicists, more than anyone else. It's a conspiracy of a military science industrial complex. And we, instead of going into a direction where we could have developed genetics, if we had given biologists full run and provided them with that much money, we would have immortality by now. Just by sheer genetic engineering, we would be able to prolong our lives if we had put that much energy into it. But we gave it all to the physicists. And what do we have? We don't have flying cars. We don't have nuclear-powered planes. We don't have nuclear-powered mobility. We have nothing they promised us. All we have is a broken economy because basically they took everything and they stole it. And so this is all based on the American myth that the atomic bombs won the war. Everything's based on, well, it stopped the war. Well, I'll give you an example of how phony that is. I was talking earlier about if John Lear was so hot, how come the Vietnam air battles produced so many American pilots being shot down. Why wasn't he in the lines with the fighter pilots? Well, because he's a rich guy's son and he's flying drugs with the CIA. Now you take a look at Nixon. Nixon knew the score because he was involved with trying to start Operation Vulture. And Nixon, at that point in time, was under the impression, based on his being misinformed by the military, he was under the impression as a vice president that the atomic bombs had ended the war. So on March 20th of 1954, he instigated Operation Vulture with Secretary of State John Foster Dulles and Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Arthur Ranford. And they approached Eisenhower, and they said, we've got two aircraft carriers have entered the Gulf of Tonkin. We've got B-29s ready to Clark Field in the Philippines. We've got elements of the 3rd Marine Division placed on alert. 100 aircraft were involved. 5 U.S. servicemen were captured by the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu. They became the first U.S. prisoners of war of the Vietnam War, 1954. Now, they approached Eisenhower, and they said, we're ready to drop the bombs. We've got the entire Strategic Air Command ready to beat them in Vietnam just the way they did the Japanese in World War II. And Eisenhower looked at him and he said, are you crazy? The Japanese never surrendered in World War II. He said, those atomic bombs didn't do anything. They were meaningless. It was a propaganda operation. Nothing was accomplished, and nothing will be accomplished here. And the entire Operation Vulture was closed down. Later on, Nixon never forgot that. And in 1972, December 19th, he approached the U.S. Air Force and the Strategic Air Command. He said, you bastards told me you won World War II. Let's see if you can really stop a war. I want to end the Vietnam War. You've got 11 days. I want you to bomb Hanoi, and I want you to end this war. And Operation Linebacker 2 started. He said, I got a bomb before Congress reconvenes after January 1st of 1973. And I'm going to suspend it for 36 hours over Christmas. And I'm going to have you, the SAC chief, General John C. Mayer, win this war like you claimed you won World War II. Now, the only U.S. planes capable of winter all-weather bombing were the Air Force B-52s. And there weren't enough General Dynamics F-111s or Navy Grumman A-6 intruders available for the campaign due to chronic combat losses because their pilots kept getting shot down by Vietnamese air aces, by a Vietnamese Air Force that Americans don't even know existed. So on the night of the 12th and the 18th of 1972 in December, all these B-52s, they took off from Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, from Utapao Air Base in Thailand. First night, 3 B-52s were lost to surface-to-air missiles. A B-52 is literally like a stealth bomber. We're talking about, for that day and age, the equivalent in cost, almost $1 billion. December 21st, 6 B-52s got shot down. Hanoi was able to claim it was a Dien Bien Phu of the air. 6% of the B-52 loss rate was unsustainable, given the relatively small number of B-52s available, and Strategic Air Command refused to communicate with the 7th Air Force in-country in Vietnam because they were the pampered favorites. They were the boys who were never supposed to see combat. And in all, 15 B-52s and 9 other aircraft were lost over Hanoi. You know what that is? That's the equivalent of the entire 509th atomic bomber wing getting shot down over Tokyo. Their combat performance was execrable. And the end result is the entire Air Force was a scam. What did they do after that? They retreated underground. They realized, hey, you know what? We just weren't meant to fly. And so they said, we're going to run missiles instead. And so they said, from now on, we're just going to defend the American public by going underground, sitting in these comfortable chairs, and pressing 000 8 times to do a launch first strike until somebody figures out how much we scammed them. Well, no one ever did figure out how much they scammed them. These are the boys who keep saying it's aliens at Roswell. I want you to keep that in mind whenever you think about them. Everyone says, hey, you got to believe there's aliens at Roswell. 509th Bomber Group said there was aliens at Roswell. Yeah, they won the war. Yeah. But this is what they're all about. I could go on for hours about their level of corruption.
You know, as much as this is, again, an unpleasant message, it does give me hope, because if they were the supermen they claimed, there would be no hope in beating them. But if there are competent idiots, there's a hope that they'll beat themselves.
Pretty much. I mean, they are criminals. Well, what they've certainly beaten is us. That's what they've beaten, is the American public. They've beaten the American public into buying their BS about what they've done in wartime. They've bought the American public into supporting them in peacetime. The end result is they should not exist as an organization. They are a criminal organization. They're an organization of traitors. They need to be dismantled, and whatever leadership survives needs to be put on trial in terms of from World War II all the way on up. I mean, let me give you an example of this, the strategic bombing. Who organized strategic bombing? Back in the days when war was a gentleman's pursuit, the sport of kings, Teddy Roosevelt organized the Rough Riders. On their collar tabs, you can look this up, the uniform said USGV, United States Gentlemen Volunteers. Later on, come World War I, you had poor boys, comparatively speaking, like Charles Lindbergh, who flew in the Escadrille Lafayette, the French version of the French Foreign Legion, fighting the Germans. Now, who are the rich guys? They all flew in the Millionaires Unit, fighting the Germans on the fields of France, taken off from the fields of France in World War I. Millionaires Unit organized, after World War I, the strategic air bombing concept. These were the guys who originated what became ultimately Strategic Air Command after the U.S. Army Air Corps, which performed in World War II. Who were these guys in the Millionaires Unit? Every single one of them was a skull and bonesman from Yale. That's verifiable. You can vet that. You can look up the Millionaires Unit. You can look up every single one of their histories. You had to be a member of Yale fraternity Skull and Bones to be a member of the Millionaires Unit. These were the fathers of strategic air power and strategic air command in the United States. And you want to know why it behaves the way it does?
No, this is quite amazing stuff, quite unfortunate stuff, but the difference between then and now is that we are hearing it, thanks to your work, but we are hearing it, which means maybe that might signal that there might be something around the corner that might be happening. People would waking up and stop to take this, combined with their disintegration. Maybe everything might end up with a whimper instead of a bang.
That's correct. And the World War II version of the Millionaires Unit was the OSS. Wild Bill Donovan and a bunch of rich white frat boys who were mostly skull and bonesmen said, hey, we're too elite to be taking orders from some commissioned officer. We want a war to be an adventure on our own terms. So they organized the OSS, Office of Strategic Services. That was all about parachute jumping behind enemy lines, doing sabotage, sleeping with local women. When they jumped out of those planes, they used to scream Geronimo. Where does that come from? The Skull and Bones initiation rite, where they put their hands on the skull of the great Indian warrior chief Geronimo, which was sawed off by George Prescott Bush Sr. and shipped over to Skull and Bones fraternity, where they're still skull effing this guy generations later, even though the American Indians want that skull back and have been lobbying for it for years. And so these OSS guys, that was supposedly the forerunner of the CIA. Not the case. They were dismantled, all went home years, 2 years at least, before the CIA was organized in 1947. They at least were about cloak and dagger, penetration, sabotage. CIA is just about shuffling papers like a champ.
Well, Douglas, that music says our time is up, and it's been a very productive 3 hours. And we can go on to for 30, but people can go to your website, DouglasDietrich.com, and can actually see you in person. Could you go through that real quick again?
Yes. On June 23rd of this year in San Rafael in Marin County, please look up the SuperSoldierSummit.com. I'll be delivering the opening presentation for that day. It's a summit like no other. We're dealing with the victims of MKUltra and mind control programs under the military office.
And we will be back many times, I hope, and as we continue to do this. Of course, as usual, this programs will be downloadable. I'm looking to put out a YouTube version of this, which would be very interesting. And I'm also looking at putting together a torrent containing all of your visits here, so people can get that through the torrent system. Douglas, thank you very much. God bless, and we will talk again.
I look forward to it, and may we all be here next time.
Yes, that's a little qualifier we should add there. Well, anyway, God willing, and the prions don't rise, we will see you back next week live on Feet to the Fire. Remember, it's Friday nights now. And here we go.
The ancient one of my old friend, the one who walked before, the one who walked again, the ancient one of old, with wisdom for the new. Revive our inner sight, retell your timeless truths. Oh, it's your word.
Feet to Fire is a production of IPS Media Works on the OnSIC Radio Network of Stations.